Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, going to talk more about the fiscal charade. Yes, you got to love the charade game. More crisis, more down to the last minute, more hostage situations. Ooh, heart-pumping thrill ride. Oh, yes, down to the last minute. Thing is, the more we know about the grand deal there, or the, you know, the whatever you want to call it, the more I don't like it. And I still want to know why 85 Republicans voted for the bill. You know, the people who said, well, we care about debt and deficits, and we're never going to tax the rich people. Why'd they vote for it? What was in it for them? What was the sweetener? Huh. Could it be the fact that we made the Bush tax cuts permanent for, well, over, what, 99.3% of the population? Permanent. Bush couldn't even do that. Also going to talk about another day, another story on crumbling infrastructure here in Harrisburg as a another sinkhole almost swallows up a backhoe. Interesting there. Also going to talk about the global rich who are revolting. Hell no, we won't pay. We're going to Russia. Yeah, Russian citizenship up for purchase, I guess. Also, as we found out, the Muslims are buying up the airwaves. Run! Be afraid. The Muslims are coming. That's right. Al Jazeera bought up Current TV. We're going to talk a little bit about that. Also, you know, while Chris Christie played the outraged role yesterday, we're going to talk about his push not to let a good crisis go to waste. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Big story for me today that didn't get an awful lot of attention, in my opinion, but I think it's huge globally. The IMF, well, not the IMF itself, their economic counselor, he and their research department economist published a paper today basically saying, well, you know, oops, kind of screwed that up. We didn't realize that when you take a dollar out of the economy, that it would be more than the 50 cents that we thought. Our model was off. It's not that we were wrong. Our model was off. What they're saying is that instead of the 50 cents that we thought it was going to take out of the economy, well, it kind of took a buck and a half out and made things worse. And this is what we've been saying from the beginning of this Bush crisis, from the beginning of all this, from the start of the Republicans and all of their conservative mouthpieces running around saying, oh, we need to cut, cut, cut. We need a new word for Americans, austerity. And it's something that I had talked about for years before anyone in Congress mentioned the word or any of the media mentioned the word, because we had seen it around the globe. We've seen where, you know, big corporations go in and thanks to the IMF and buy up everything. And government who saddled with debt because, well, they borrowed money from the IMF and the World Bank and got themselves into trouble, how they had to privatize everything. What you've seen in banana republics around the world are what they're trying to do here in the U.S. And to me, it is, I look at Argentina, and I talk a lot about Argentina because while we were going through September 11th and the recession that came through because of that and the Bush policies and all of that as well, Argentina was in a free fall collapse because they had bought into the conservative worldview. You know, you sell off all of your social safety net, you do away with all that, you give corporations the ability to do whatever the hell they want, and you have no borders to capital, none of that stuff. So as soon as September 11th happened, you saw this kind of hiccup, all the hot money left Argentina, and the country collapsed. And they had no social safety net left. They had privatized everything. Their social security system, their welfare system, everything was privatized, which is what we're hearing today. Oh, we need to do away with Medicare and social security and privatize vouchers, everything. Because we need to get that off our books. And they want to do it with the pension system. You know, here in the state of Pennsylvania, you're going to hear it. Oh, we need to go to a 401k. And oh, we need to put that money in Wall Street. Oh, we need to gamble it away. No safety net. No checks, no balances, no way of reacting to massive crisis, putting us in the same position as a country like Argentina. so that now when you have a debt problem, and look, we've got a debt, long-term debt problem. I'm not concerned short-term. Long-term, if it sustains for 20, 30 more years, yeah, I'm worried. But right now, I'm sorry, not the time to be pursuing the IMF model of austerity. Cut, cut, and punish ain't helping. And if you look at Europe, and the right loves to go, see, look at Europe, that socialist country, and look what it... The reason they're having the problems is they're transitioning to wanting to be us with our massive inequality, where we have a billionaire class second to none. And those folks, they don't want everybody to have health care. They don't want everyone to have some measure of retirement. Europe wants to emulate the U.S. with their billionaire class. And you poor people, if you can't afford health care, you die. So I look at this report published by the good folks there at the IMF who now understand, you know, these two people saying, well, you know, while we work for the IMF, this isn't necessarily the views of the IMF, even though these are people way up at the top who are saying, oops, made a mistake. And they're also saying, look, you know, the IMF, they weren't the only ones. The European Commission, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, the Economist Intelligence Unit, a whole bunch of these people made the same, oops, our models were off. Well, you know what those models did? Those models hurt people. Oops, sorry, you've got 25, 30% unemployment. Oops, sorry, Greece. Sorry, Spain. Sorry. Yeah, we pulled all this money out of your economy and it collapsed. Why? Because we understand that demand grows an economy. Now, what they've done a masterful job of doing, understand what the right has done a masterful job globally, not just here in the U.S., but globally, what they've done a masterful job of convincing people. If we save money in government spending, we don't have to raise money in taxes. Without understanding that governments are one of the biggest demand generators. So if we're not investing in infrastructure, which here in Harrisburg is literally crumbling under our feet, if we're not investing in infrastructure, if we're not building roads and bridges, if we're not providing education, if we're not getting health care to people, if we're not doing sane, smart things, if we're not investing, if we're not building, if we're not growing, we're dying. And that's what you're seeing in Europe. You're seeing as they pull, and this is perfectly common sense. If you pull money out of the economy, it contracts. And as it contracts, it only gets worse because then everybody starts to contract. And it's no surprise to me that the Gallup USA Today poll just out today says, well, most people think 2013 is going to be a horrible economic year. Yeah, because they've just gone through 2 years of Republicans saying, oh, we're going to go off the cliff. The end of the world's coming. This is dysfunctional. And there's no fun in this either. The Republicans have put us really in a screwed position. At a time when for the last 2 years we should have been investing in roads and bridges and broadband access and education. We've been firing teachers. We've been dumping cops. We've been dumping firefighters. We've been canning public sector workers. And we've been causing job losses. And when that happens there, money comes out of the economy. And as that school teacher loses her or his paycheck, you know what? They're not spending the money at the local restaurant or the local grocery store. And guess what happens? They've got to lay people off. It's common sense. And yet I hear people, my right-wing friends, wow, we need tax cuts. What the hell do tax cuts do when someone doesn't have a job? Explain that to me. Someone please, because I'm missing the point. When we lost nearly 20,000 education professionals in this state over the last 2 years, 20,000 jobs gone, just in that one industry, gone. What did a tax cut mean to those people? Nothing, because they didn't have any income. But I'll tell you what it meant to the kids who sat in those overcrowded classrooms. It meant less attention. It meant a worse education. Oh, but, you know, Sue Helms says, we put all the money back. Which I'm still trying to figure out how the hell that happened. If you say I'm taking $2 billion and you only take $1 billion out of education, you didn't put $1 billion back. You cut $1 billion from education, which is what this governor has done. And when you pull that money out of the local economy, it harms the local economy. And what we're seeing is, you know, this whole push. Well, we want spending cuts. We want to cut Social Security. We want to cut Medicare. We want to cut all across the board. And what does that mean? Well, that means the U.S., if you look at what's being proposed and what got passed through, we're right up there with Britain. In fact, we've got more austerity going on than Britain had, more than France, more than Spain. Still not to Portugal and Greece, but still more than Spain and France. And what's it done to that area? Well, they double-dip recessed. So and look, the people in the poll that Gallup and USA Today polled and said, oh, it's going to be a bad year, I don't blame them for thinking that. Those are the smart people who've realized, uh-oh, they're pulling money out of the economy. That job, that could be mine. Or it could be the neighbor who I depend on for my job. Yet all I hear from the Republicans, well, we need to cut spending. We don't need to raise revenue. We don't need to make sure that folks have jobs. No. All I heard was, well, we need to freeze those public sector pensions, and we need to freeze those public sector workers' paychecks. In fact, the federal workers, it's been, what, 2-3 years now that they haven't seen a raise frozen? They wanted to freeze it for another couple of years? That's bad economics. You want to get this economy turned around, you get money into people's pockets. How do you do that? Well, you give them jobs. See, kind of like we did during the Depression. Got people back to work. They got money in their pockets. They felt a little confident. I got a couple of bucks. They spent it in the local economy. Somebody said, hey, I should start a store because people want stuff. And it creates a couple jobs. It's a spiraling up. More money in the local economy, the more jobs that are being created, the more economic activity that happens. And as the IMF just said, they've just realized, oops, we made a mistake. For every dollar we take out of the economy, oops, a buck and a half comes out. What did we save? Oh, that's right. Nothing. We've gone into debt, 50 cents for every dollar we've taken out. Figure that one out to me because I'm not getting it. But if you'll remember, it's exactly what I said was going to happen. And I'm telling you right now, if we allow these Republicans to keep pushing this, well, you know, and hey, it sounds so common sense. Well, you know, just like at the Smith household, just at the kitchen table, when I don't have enough money, I tighten my belt a little bit and I got to suck it up. And understand, government is not the Smith household. There are things that I can do without for a couple of days. There are things that I can turn the cable off. Government can't turn off the water supply. Government can't turn off the police department. Can't turn off the fire department. Can't turn off the military. Can't turn off paying granny Social Security or helping with Medicare or disasters. Can't turn that off. I'm sorry. And guess what else they can't do? See, some people, they get themselves into trouble, file bankruptcy. It's all clear. All forgiven. Sorry, government doesn't do that. They're the last resort, man. So I love hearing these people saying, well, you know, it's just like kitchen table economics. Nonsense. It's not. And all of this discussion, all we have to do is just cut spending. Well, what does that mean? You never hear what they want to cut. And I've yet to hear Boehner or anyone articulate what it is we're going to cut. I know what Governor Corbett has cut. I know that right when he took office, he kicked 41,000 low-waged workers off of meager health care benefits, kicked them to the curb, which means they have nothing. So if they get sick, one of two things happens. They die, or they cost us, the taxpayers, considerably more. Because, of course, they're going to go to the hospital. The hospital is going to write that off, of course, at much higher rates because they're going to go to the emergency room. They're going to write that off, and that's going to be a nice tax loop right off for them, and we pay that. I mean, at some point, don't we have to think in some rational thought? And then you've got a party that wanted to hold this country hostage all the way to the end because we're not going to let anyone raise taxes on the wealthy people without asking, who exactly are we talking about raising taxes on? We're not going to raise taxes on the cop. or the firefighter or the teacher or the guy who serves me, breakfast in the morning. I'm talking about people who live in their gated communities, fly on private jets. And, oh, but Rick, that's economic class warfare. Yeah. How do you think we got to this position? They have been kicking our behinds for generations now. Explain to me, when you look at the things, the policies that have gone on over the last 30 years, where we have created the largest billionaire class in history, where do you think that money came from? Where do you think that wealth came from? It didn't just come out of thin air. It came out of your pocket. It came out of every working person's pocket in this country. Because as productivity and wage gains decoupled, the wage gains from our increased productivity went to the very top, not to you and me. It's pretty simple stuff. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back. Together we will live on forevermore. Now we have defended from all things I can hold.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. The Senate compromise on the so-called fiscal cliff will in many ways act as a band-aid, passing a number of issues created by the current Congress onto the next Congress. The massive spending cuts, known as the sequester, will be delayed for 2 months. In order to cover some of the costs, there will be discretionary cuts in both defense and welfare programs. The payroll tax holiday will expire, resulting in a 2% increase in payroll taxes. The debt ceiling wasn't touched at all in the fiscal patch. A farm bill that had long been languishing in Congress will see a 9-month extension. If that bill had not been pushed through, milk prices could have doubled or tripled in 2013, with some regions of the country paying as much as $8 per gallon. The bill failed to include disaster relief funds for those still recovering from the impact of Superstorm Sandy. It also doesn't solve the issue of spending cuts creating what will undoubtedly be a second fiscal cliff in early March. Some of the other changes include the estate tax being raised to 40% for those above the $400,000 threshold, but also includes an exemption of $5 million. The capital gains tax will be set at 20% for those earning more than $400,000. The Bush-era tax cuts were made permanent for any families with income below $400,000 and individuals under $450,000. Tax rates above that amount will revert to Clinton-era tax rates. Three Democrats broke ranks and voted against the Senate compromise. Iowa Senator Tom Harkin was among them, and he said the bill benefited the wealthiest Americans on the backs of the poor.
Wisconsin's Mark Pocan is one of the new freshman crop of U.S. House members coming into Congress in 2013. Pocan says there will be plenty of unfinished economic business for the new Congress to wade into, and he's hoping for a new posture and attitude in the new U.S. House despite it still being in Republican control. Pocan made it clear that his vote will be opposed to Social Security and Medicare cuts as Congress works its way through fiscal issues.
And there's talks about benefit cuts, and you know, I think those programs are just so valuable and they're so popular, that's not where we should be looking. But you know, I also think I want to add to those programs for protecting also things that just, you know, help the most vulnerable. You know, they really can't afford anymore, and I think we really have to make sure we're doing this in a very smart way. So I'm hoping that the conversations, I'm seeing many people on both sides of the aisle start to have a more reasonable tone. I haven't quite seen it from the Republican leadership yet, but I'm seeing it from some of the Republican members, and I think that's a very positive trend.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thoughts are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left, make shit from red. Father shot that candy on blue denim, head is fake. Oh, he's a working class man.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So, interesting news from the Financial Times. According to them, now remember, you know, the big deal, the big fiscal cliff deal, made sure that a number of corporate tax breaks stayed right in line. You know, the one for NASCAR, and of course one for rum producers. Gotta get your rum. But as the Financial Times points out, big banks, they're going to be able to park their money overseas. According to them, U.S. banks and other large cross-border companies will retain a key tax break covering billions of dollars in foreign income under this week's fiscal cliff deal. So, hey, you know what? All that money that's parked overseas, get ready for the call for repatriation. Oh, Rick, you know, we could bring that money back. We could bring that money back. Great jobs with it, like we did last time. Oh, I'm sorry, not last time. Forget last time. No, forget last time. Last time we actually lost 100-some thousand jobs and created no jobs and all really did harmed our tax base. But hey, it did do well for the CEOs because they gave themselves huge bonuses based on their stock awards because they bought back a lot of the company stocks and raised the price and shareholders were happy. And good for them anyway, right? And that's what's really important. It's really important that our CEO class, the wealthy in this country, feel like they're respected, don't you think? Isn't that important? Yeah, that's important. Huh. Here's my problem. I look at what's going on here in Harrisburg. And for the last 3 days, there have been sinkholes that have opened up. On day one, there was a sinkhole that almost swallowed a garbage truck. On day two, another one, just a couple hours later, broken gas lines, shut part of the Capitol building down. And then today, a sinkhole almost swallows up a backhoe. Aha. Uh-huh. So what they're saying is this is a problem of erosion. And this is what I said the other night. This is erosion. I mean, the water gets in there and just erodes the ground underneath, and eventually the asphalt will collapse. And we have no idea, and this may be the new game. Dare to walk the streets and not fall in. Because as they point out, the pipes underneath the street were installed in 1890. I thought, they put these water pipes in, you know, during the Depression, get people busy, get back to work. Evidently, it was the Depression of the 1880s, 1890s. That they decided the works program would be a good idea then. 120-year-old pipes. And I loved what the guy who is the Department of Public Works head guy, who was asked, how do we stop it? You know, how do you stop it? And he said, you don't. Difficult. We got 150 miles of pipeline underground. And who knows where things are leaking and what's eroding. It's going to be a game. So instead of saying, and they have no idea how much this is going to cost. They said somewhere in the six figures, it's going to cost a lot of money. But more importantly, it's going to shut down areas, and you're going to have all of this disruption. Instead of saying, you know what, we should be investing in upgrading this stuff. 120 years? I think you got your money's worth out of those pipes. Maybe it's time to start redoing them. Just a thought. Because you know what? We got a lot of unemployed workers. I know a lot of construction workers who would love to go back to work today. But yet all I hear from the Republicans, well, those are lazy people sitting on unemployment. No, how about putting them back to work? How about a jobs bill? Just a thought. Maybe so we don't have to open up the newspaper every day or turn on the radio and hear somebody going, you know what? Huge sinkhole almost swallowed up a garbage truck. Oh, sinkhole, almost swallowed up a backhoe. Water main broke. Bridge collapsed. How much more? And I remember having a conversation with someone who said, well, you know, water eroded the ground. Well, how do you stop water? It's the pipes underneath. You know, and it reminded me at the time of what they claimed brought down the I-35 bridge in Minneapolis. It was bird droppings. The birds. The birds were going on the bridge. And whatever the bird dropping is corrosive and rusted the... And maybe that's perfectly plausible. Maybe that is the reason. But you know what really caused that bridge's collapse? The fact that for a couple of years, they knew it was going to collapse and did nothing. Because they... Well, we don't have the money. We need to cut taxes. And this is what drives me insane. Because then you have people who go, look, the city's failing because they're not fixing roads and bridges, but they don't have any money because we've given it all away in tax handouts. And especially these tax handouts to these corporations who are going to do business here anyway. And I'm still nuts over the cracker plant, a plant they were going to build in that spot anyway. But we gave $1.7 billion away. That's $1.7 billion we could have educated kids with, or heaven forbid, upgraded our infrastructure. And for all of the talk of, oh, we're going to be Greece, I don't know if you've seen the rates at which we can borrow money for long term. There are countries that are giving us money almost interest-free just to hold as a guard against, because they're buying into all inflation coming. So I'm of the mindset, why not borrow it? But here again, it doesn't fit into the right-wing frame that the free market, the invisible hand, the invisible man will take care of it. When was the last time an invisible man built a bridge? I don't know. I don't know of any time. I know when the free market built a bridge. I know of one going from Detroit to Canada. It's probably one of the most expensive bridges to cross in the country. You know, there are things that we do for ourselves, we the people collectively, that benefit all of us, like roads and bridges, like education, things that we used to believe were common. We all had these things in common, parks and libraries and all of this stuff. We have been sold this false bill of goods that we need to pay homage to the wealth class. And I listened to a couple of screeds today about people going on about, well, you know, if you tax the rich people, they're not going to be charitable. Heard this screed endlessly. In fact, Glenn Beck on his program this morning went into this long, bizarre rant about how he's a super charitable guy and he does all this stuff. And he does it because of the goodness of his heart, but he might not be able to because the tax break went away. And I'm going, well, hold on a second. Explain this to me because I'm struggling. Because I've had this conversation with folks of significant means in the past where they tell me out of one side of their mouth that, well, it's good to be charitable and it feels good, makes you feel good, and it's good for the community. That's the Christian thing to do. It's the right thing to do. And we shouldn't have government doing anything. Government shouldn't be providing homeless shelters or food banks or any government should do nothing. It should all be private charity. And then out of the other side of their mouth, they tell me, oh, but if I don't get that tax break, I'm not going to do it. If I don't feel respected, I'm not going to do it. And I go, this is exactly why I don't want you doing it. And look, I'm in favor of people being charitable. I want you to be charitable, but for the right reasons. Not because there's a tax break there. Because it's the right thing to do. And we as society, collectively, have things that we take care of. We shouldn't be relying on good times, because, you know, charity goes up during good times. So when you might need the charity, you don't have the money because, hey, when times are tough, times are tough. And this is what drives me nuts about these people who scream, we need a balanced budget amendment. Yeah, so when things go awry, we have a recession, and a lot of people lose their homes and lose their jobs and need assistance. But we can't do anything because tax revenues drop because they don't have jobs. Where does the money come from? Oh, that's right, nowhere. Oh, we expect private charity. Well, guess what? They don't have it either. I mean, as you're listening to the argument that the right makes about charity, it's a great argument. If you buy it. And if that were the case, we tried that for 150 years in this country. Didn't work. Sorry. Been there. Done that. Saw the movie. Ended poorly. Ended with long lines. So I listened to this whole screed that he went on about, well, you know, I'm a charitable guy and I'm not going to do that. Then he turned around, I'm going to start doing it. And it was really just a very bizarre rant by a very wealthy guy, an extraordinarily wealthy guy, who went on to some nonsense about his kids having to go and feed the cows and cut the grass, and how, you know, liberals would be, well, that's a good thing. And it was just really, and I'm sitting there going, I can't believe I'm listening to this. Because it makes no sense for a working person. This is just a rich person's screed. This is just their little tirade. It's their little tizzy fit. The reality is the vast majority of working people in this country have nothing in common with the Glenn Becks of the world, the Limbaughs, the wealth class. The people who were affected by this tax increase, trust me, they're just fine. Thank you very much. And have never had it so good. And this idea that, well, if you don't, and this is why I'm very, very, very serious about this, which is why I don't think charitable giving should be deducted at all. It should be the right thing. I shouldn't be incentivizing the Carnegies and the Mellons and the Becks and the Buffetts and whoever else to put their name on a building. I shouldn't be incentivizing them to put their name on a library. They should do it because it's right. No? Especially when you're talking about rates as low as they are. When the top marginal rate was 92%, as it was during the good socialist president Dwight David Eisenhower's administration, I could make an argument for, hey, let's incentivize things like building schools and building hospitals and building libraries. Let Carnegie throw his name on it. I'm all in when it was 92%. Now that you're talking about a third of that? Sorry, we don't have the money. We just don't. And if you believe, as the right keeps throwing out, that we're going to be Greece, that we're debt-ridden and we can do nothing, you have to bring more revenue in as any household. If we're going to use the household frame that the right wants us to keep doing, any household goes out and brings in more revenue. Because there's only so much of the bone you can chop off before you say, you know what? I got to get a second job. I got to bring more revenue into the household. Just nonsensical. When we come back, I want to talk about the cliff a little bit more. I like what Charles Blow had to say. Cliff after cliff. Quick break, right back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Such energy powers as BP, ExxonMobil, Halliburton, and Koch Industries have gone crackers over fracking. Seeing huge profits from this dreadfully destructive and dangerously dirty method of forcing natural gas out of rock formations deep in the earth, the industry is presently scurrying all over the country, asking landowners to sign contracts, allowing them to drill and frack on farms, parkland, playgrounds, and even people's backyards. But now, in cities and rural areas alike, this unbridled gas rush has become a matter of deeply grave concern. Literally. In the shriveled, ethical universe of these fracking profiteers, money trumps everything, and nothing is sacred. Not even graveyards, the eternal resting place of our loved ones. Yes, gas frackers across the country are out to get drilling rights in hundreds of cemeteries, promising maintenance money to caretakers in exchange for letting the corporations sink their explosive siphons down under the dearly departed. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, and mineral rights to Exxon. How spiritual. Oh, come on, snapped the industry's impatient hustlers. The fracking takes place way underground, so it won't disturb the graves. Yeah, but what about the souls? A cemetery is a spiritual sanctuary, a place of respect, serenity, and moral decorum. But a fracking corporation has no soul, and its moral concerns penetrate no deeper than its bottom line. For a measure of just how shallow corporate morality is, note that the frackers even threaten the hallowed ground of some of our veteran cemeteries. Their ethos is clear. Hey, out of the way. Decorum is one thing, but there's money under those graves. This is Jim Hightower saying they're fracturing our deepest values. To fight this, go to foodandwaterwatch.org. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The walls come tumbling down. The walls come tumbling, tumbling. The walls come tumbling, tumbling down.
Or in the case here in Harrisburg, the roads keep crumbling down. I mean, three sinkholes, 3 days. What's tomorrow going to bring us? Don't hold your breath. Jeez. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Well, the hostage crisis is going to continue, or as Charles Blow points out in his New York Times op-ed, cliff after cliff. He says, look, you know what we've been seeing, all of these cliffs, it's like an M.C. Escher drawing of cliffs. And I like that analogy because it's what we've seen the last couple of years. It's one after another, and they're all intertwined in each other. And he points out, look, the reality is there's no reason to celebrate what happened. No reason to celebrate. He said this is a mournful moment. He says we, and by we, he says he means Congress. And by Congress, he says he means the Republican Congress. They have demonstrated just how broken and paralyzed our government has become, how beholden to hostage takers, and how vulnerable to extremism. He says the fiscal cliff deal was cut at the last possible minute, covering a minimal number of issues. It was far from perfect and barely palatable, and I agree totally with that. Barely palatable. He said it was a compromise, and compromises are inherently imperfect. No one likes the whole of it, but they balance the bad parts against the good and see beyond dissension. I'm sorry, I'm still wondering. And I've had some folks tell me that, you know, the 85 Republicans who voted for it decided that, you know, this is an election issue already. This is an election issue. Think about this. This was the 112th Congress voting on this. This is an election issue. Their election is in 2 years. Stop and think about how badly broken our system is when you're already thinking about running for re-election before you've even taken office. I mean, that just blows the mind. Before you've been sworn into the 113th, you're worried about running for the 114th. Charles Blow writes, the American people suffered through another moment of manufactured suspense brought on by political malpractice. He said there was no grand bargain. There was only a begrudging acquiescence. Not only in the era of grand bargains is over, as he says that General Steinhauer wrote in the Times on Tuesday, he says that he believes the era of basic government has screeched to a halt. And, you know, the Steinhauer one pointed out that, and this was something we talked about, I had talked about the other day with a friend. You know, we were talking about the do-nothing Congress of the Truman years, and how they had enacted, you know, I think it was like 900 laws during this one stint. The Republican-led Congress passed 173 laws. Making them, if 900, 950, if that's do nothing, what's 173? And, you know, I come back to this quite often. What the right has continually told me, what conservatives have continually told me, is they want no government. They don't believe in it. They don't want it. They really want to break it. So what we have right before us are people who want, people like me who believe that things need to get done. We need to have schools, and we need to have hospitals, and we need to have police force and fire protection, and we need to have all of these things that society runs on. Without it, you have chaos. And then there are people who want the chaos because they believe somehow in their mind that chaos is better than what we have, that somehow the invisible man is going to come and make everything just right and perfect, that this invisible hand is going to do all of these things that we have done for ourselves these years. So you vote for people who have told you. They don't believe in what they're going to do. They believe in nothing that comes out of Washington. So are we surprised that nothing gets done? And then we keep hearing this election from the Republicans that, well, the American people voted for divided government. And while to a degree I'm in favor of divided government as long as it's functional, I don't believe that to be the case. And as Blow points out in his op-ed, he pointed to an Economist article from November, which is something we talked about back then, that said, you know what, hey, the president won almost 51% of the vote. Romney got 40, 47, something like that. In the Senate, Democrats got something close to 54% of the vote. Republicans got somewhere around 52%. In the House, Democrats got nearly 50, 49, almost 50% of the vote. Republicans, 48. That's not really a call for divided government. It sounds to me to be a sweep. Here in the state of Pennsylvania, I think it was really very clear. All of the statewide races were won by Democrats. Yet, the state is so badly gerrymandered that 13 of the 18 congressional seats went to Republicans. And as Blow points out, he says, look, we're stuck in this reckless, whining, ultimately dangerous gaggle of wounded spirits. He's talking about Republicans. Because I've often said, be wary of the cornered rat. And as Blow points out, as many people can attest, an animal is often its most dangerous when it's sick, wounded, or afraid. And his advice, brace yourself, because I still don't know what these Republicans in their scorched earth policy are capable of. So I keep going back to those 85. What is it that they voted for? What haven't we seen? I'm still waiting for the other shoe to drop. I know the chain CPI isn't in there, as I fully expect it to be. And you go, well, what's that? Well, what that is over the next generation, a lowering of Social Security payments. That means granny gets less in her Social Security check. That means there's less money in the economy. That means we have higher poverty rates for seniors. We have less economic activity in our communities. Both, I think, are bad things. And I'm often amazed that we have a party in this country who wants to make the majority of people poorer and the minority considerably richer. And you look at how they deal with employment law. And to me, it all comes back down to the workplace. If you're not getting a fair share of the wealth that you're creating, I'm sorry, the economy is not working well. Because then you can't take those profits that you're helping to generate and put them back into the economy. Seems pretty simple to me. And you come back to this whole austerity argument. The more money we pull out, the more contracting our economy does, the more we cut vital social programs, the less money is in the economy, the more we spiral down. Because understand, economies don't stay stagnant. They go in one of two directions. We're either going up or we're going down. And right now we seem to be spiraling down. Not as much as we were when Bush was president, which was a free fall. Some of the policies that Obama pushed for have stopped that free fall and turned the tide, and we are slowly digging out, slowly. But you have got a Republican Congress, a recalcitrant Republican Congress, who they don't care about that. It's all about their political win. So I'm still wondering what those 85, what they think they want. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
While the poor man pays the fan, oh, there's still me for killing me. Lord, have mercy on the working man.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can. And we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Earth, sky.
Maybe you've heard somewhere about planet Nibiru. This Nibiru, which has made a big splash on the internet, will supposedly collide with Earth in 2012.
Which, while interesting, is not true. There is no planet Nibiru. There's not the slightest trace of a ripple of it anywhere near Earth, or anywhere else in our solar system.
The claim is that it's a large world, around the size of the giant planets Jupiter and Saturn, with an orbital period of 3,600 years. If that were so, Nibiru should be inside Jupiter's orbit by now. Dazzling Jupiter, the fifth planet outward from our sun, is impossible to miss with the unaided eye. In fact, you can even view Jupiter's 4 major moons with ordinary binoculars. But no Nibiru.
Some claim that Nibiru was closest to Earth between August 17th and September 26th. If it was, no one saw it.
We have a great video at EarthSky.org, courtesy of David Morrison, senior scientist at the NASA Astrobiology Institute at NASA Ames Research Center in California. In the video, Morrison explains why there's simply no Nibiru. He says he hopes the non-arrival of Nibiru will serve as a teaching moment for the public on, quote, rational thought and baloney detection.
See the video and learn who originated the idea of a planet called Nibiru at EarthSky.org. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time. The Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alert.
Ah, the Muslims are coming! The Muslims are coming! According to the Beckians. Glenn Beck doing his little screed this morning on charity also went into, you know, whining about Al Jazeera. Evidently Al Jazeera bought Current TV from Al Gore, and that has them just in a tizzy. And I gotta be honest, nobody watched Current. I don't think anybody's gonna watch Al Jazeera. I know very few people who watch the BBC channel. I don't care one way or another. It's just another of the hundreds of channels that I don't watch. pretty simple stuff. But I think they overpaid $500 million. Gore got his money back. Where Beck was chafed is he wanted to buy Current. And they told him no. And I wouldn't have sold it to him either. Sorry, just not happening. I would have given it to people pushing pink unicorns or something. Interesting story from Russia. Vladimir Putin, in his annual news conference last month, basically said, look, you know, if this guy named Gerard Depardieu, you might know him, he's an actor. I've seen him in a couple of things, couldn't tell you offhand what movies he's been in, don't really care, Rumpelstiltskin or something, I don't know. Evidently, Gerard, not happy with his French citizenship because the newly elected leadership there in France said, you know what, we think that rich people should pay a higher tax. 75%, kind of higher. Nothing that we would ever discuss in this country. But, hey, you know, they're saying, look, we've got problems. We need to solve our debt problems. A lot of that has been by not taxing the very wealthy over the generations. It's now time to, hey, times are tough. We've got to all pitch in. Well, Gerard, not happy, doesn't feel appreciated, says that he's going to move. First said he was going to go, I think it was to Belgium, which has a lower rate. I think it was in the instead of the 75% range, it was somewhere in the 50% range. Well, Russia has I think Belgium is 60%. Russia has a flat tax, 13%. Now, get into all the other stuff. Their value added tax and their social security taxes, and they're right. They're still above us. But don't get into details. Putin says, hey, we'll grant you citizenship. You can come and bring your millions here, and we'll be happy to allow you to not help our citizens either. And, you know, as I thought about this, and I've talked about global citizens in the past. I mean, we have really created a class of wealth, not just in this country, but globally, who they have no allegiance to any country. We saw the guy who, you know, one of the co-founders of Facebook said he was going to renounce his American citizenship. And I said, good, bye, go. And I think the people of France will say the same thing. Good, go. Don't come back. At some point, globally, this race to the bottom is going to bring us all down. If you don't have the resources, if you don't have the money to do the things that the masses need, eventually you're going to have chaos. Now, if you look at the Russian thing, and I was reading the story on Russia's tax code, they've got a value-added tax, I think something around 18%. It's like their sales tax. They've got a social security tax of somewhere in the 30% range. You know, ours is what, 6.2, 12.4, theirs is 30%. Our sales tax generally 6, 7, 8%, depending on where you are, 18% there. And there are some who say, you know, that's what we need. We need to have a low income tax and a really very high sales tax. And again, it sounds like a good idea. Have a flat tax. And then you pay tax on what you consume. Problem is you're talking about then allowing the global wealth class, who has the ability and the assets and the wealth to be able to pick and choose. It's the rest of us who are stuck with the system that taxes at 18% on sales tax. It's the rest of us who pay the 30% Social Security tax. And I always love the people who tell me what we need, Rick, is a flat tax. And this is how the flat tax works. You pay this amount in income tax, boom, flat. You pay sales tax. And then you get into the details. And I've had this conversation a number of times because people keep bringing up to me the Steve Forbes idea, which was the 15% flat tax with a 23% sales tax. Think about that, 23%. What would that do to our economy? I mean, you're talking about a very regressive tax. You're talking about raising the cost of goods exponentially. But, Rick, you'll have more money in your pocket. Sorry, you're not going to have that much. Because as screwed up as our tax code is, there's still a bit of progressivity left in it. To where if you're making minimum wage, you're actually going to get a little bit back because we're subsidizing low-waged employers. Under that scheme, the low-waged workers, they get screwed in the worst way. And the middle class really gets hit. But it sounds good, doesn't it? It sounds enticing. Yes, it's fair. You know what's fair? And I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. You look at the policies that the wealth class has lobbied for over the years. And again, I go back to Mitt Romney's tax returns. I wanted to see them solely because I wanted to see the deductions. Because one of the screeds I heard earlier today was about that Obama's going to go after the deductions. And you're going to lose your home mortgage deduction. And that's quite possible. I seriously doubt it goes away for anyone with a mortgage under $500,000. But the way the wealth class is framed is any tax on them is a tax on all of us. We can no longer have those conversations on degrees. We don't understand nuance anymore. Kind of makes me wonder. So instead of pushing back against this whole no rights at work agenda to make work not pay and not reward work, we've somehow figured out that, well, we need tax breaks for wealthy people. Kind of makes me wonder. Kind of makes me worry. Because as I look at this, and I think about this whole flat tax and this whole tax argument that the right has won, they have made the Bush tax cuts permanent for, what, 99.3%? And we tax just the very, very tippy top and just a little bit. I mean, not even a lot. And you hear this angry screed like we're killing them. There's something wrong with us. Let's take a quick break, back with hour two of the program. If you missed any portion of the first hour, download the podcast there at the website, therickSmithShow.com. Right back after this.
Smith Show. Change America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
The Senate compromise on the so-called fiscal cliff will in many ways act as a band-aid, passing a number of issues created by the current Congress onto the next Congress. The massive spending cuts, known as the sequester, will be delayed for 2 months. In order to cover some of the costs, there will be discretionary cuts in both defense and welfare programs. The payroll tax holiday will expire, resulting in a 2% increase in payroll taxes. The debt ceiling wasn't touched at all in the fiscal patch. A farm bill that had long been languishing in Congress will see a 9-month extension. If that bill had not been pushed through, milk prices could have doubled or tripled in 2013, with some regions of the country paying as much as $8 per gallon. The bill failed to include disaster relief funds for those still recovering from the impact of Superstorm Sandy. It also doesn't solve the issue of spending cuts creating what will undoubtedly be a second fiscal cliff in early March. Some of the other changes include the estate tax being raised to 40% for those above the $400,000 threshold, but also includes an exemption of $5 million. The capital gains tax will be set at 20% for those earning more than $400,000. The Bush-era tax cuts were made permanent for any families with income below $400,000 and individuals under $450,000. Tax rates above that amount will revert to Clinton-era tax rates. Three Democrats broke ranks and voted against the Senate compromise. Iowa Senator Tom Harkin was among them, and he said the bill benefited the wealthiest Americans on the backs of the poor.
Wisconsin's Mark Pocan is one of the new freshman crop of U.S. House members coming into Congress in 2013. Pocan says there will be plenty of unfinished economic business for the new Congress to wade into, and he's hoping for a new posture and attitude in the new U.S. House despite it still being in Republican control. Pocan made it clear that his vote will be opposed to Social Security and Medicare cuts as Congress works its way through fiscal issues.
There's talks about benefit cuts, and you know, I think those programs are just so valuable and they're so popular, that's not where we should be looking. But you know, I also think I want to add to those programs for protecting also things that just, you know, help the most vulnerable. You know, they really can't afford anymore, and I think we really have to make sure we're doing this in a very smart way. So I'm hoping that the conversations, I'm seeing many people on both sides of the aisle start to have a more reasonable tone. I haven't quite seen it from the Republican leadership yet, but I'm seeing it from some of the Republican members, and I think that's a very positive trend.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We need to support people, you know, who have a history of and know what it's like to sign the front of a paycheck, not the back of a paycheck.
If you're here to represent us, listen to our cry. Say, say the USA, we're drowning in green and light. Say the USA, and we're soon a tragic fight. Stop taking all our money and shipping it to war.
Back to the second hour of the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the No Rights at Work agenda rolls on January 1st of this year. Another piece of that anti-worker conservative No Rights at Work agenda, Act 60, took effect. And, you know, the unemployment comp thing is a huge part of the No Rights at Work agenda pushed by the right in this country. Destroy benefits, destroy that safety net, destroy that security, so we can create that desperation class. And you look what they did here in Pennsylvania. The next decade are going to erode the benefits, going to make them, well, poverty. Going to make those workers desperate. And that's the whole point. And my favorite part of what they did in Act 60, the $3.5 billion that they went into debt because of the Bush era recession and because of all the folks that lost their job through no fault of their own, and the fact that employers didn't make the proper contributions, well, you know what they did? They cut benefits, and they floated a bond that you and me, the taxpayers, are responsible for at a time when they cut. Think of this. They cut the employer's rate again. So not only did they not have to pay the $3.5 billion shortfall that they created, they got a tax break on top of it. That, my friends, that's conservative economics for you. You and I, we get stuck with the bill, and they walk away fat and happy. And we're seeing this exact same thing playing out right now as we speak in North Carolina, which is why I've asked Bill Rowe, Director of Advocacy at the North Carolina Justice Center, to come talk to us about what's going on down there. Bill, thanks for taking time for me.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So I look at this, you know, here in Pennsylvania, we cut the taxable, they raised the taxable rate a tiny bit, cut the rate in half, gave employers a huge tax break where they had already gotten years of tax breaks, and, well, we're cutting the amount that folks are going to be able to have in security, and it looks like they're doing the same thing down in your neck of the woods.
Well, they absolutely are. What went on in the 90s were tremendous tax cuts for employers at points where some employers were paying no taxes for unemployment benefits. To build up our trust fund, the opposite of what we ought to have been doing with making sure our trust fund was built up so that when times were tough, it was there to be able to pay those benefits. We depleted it. We gave tremendous tax cuts during the 90s into the early 2000s, and then tremendous recession in 2001. You know, about 2008, there's no money in there. We've now wrapped up about $2.5 billion in debt to the federal government. And the proposal, most recent proposal that will probably be voted on out of a study committee next week in the North Carolina legislature, is modeled quite a bit out of the playbook of Pennsylvania, which is to drastically cut benefits and tiny increases for, I think, 0.06% tax increase for 30% of the employers, and then a tax reduction for many of the others. And so it's just remarkable in this state where we've got over 9% unemployment and are desperate and three workers for every job that we're about to go down a road of where probably no other state has gone with the reduction in unemployment that we're about to do in unemployment benefits.
And the thing that gets me, and the thing that I think average everyday work people, Joe Lunchbox needs to understand, the reason we didn't go into depression in 2008, the reason that we didn't bottom out is because we had elastic programs like food stamps, like unemployment insurance, that made sure that there was some wages still in people's pockets to be able to keep their homes and keep the lights on and keep food on the table.
Oh, absolutely. And in some parts of North Carolina, it's been one of the things that have helped those communities keep going, and some business, and the business folks, I think many of them understand it, but that they're not being heard, or they're not major players in the Chamber of Commerce and in the big fellas, that they see those benefits being spent in the stores to buy food, to buy the goods for their families, to pay the rent, keep the utilities on. And in North Carolina with the federal extension, it's been $20 million a week being contributed to workers who are out of work or then spending those dollars. So without those resources in our community, not only are the families in ruin, I mean, just the tremendous hardship they're going to face, but then those communities that are hard hit with unemployment, we have double digit in a number of areas of our state, they're going to suffer tremendously. And the business community will suffer tremendously.
And, you know, you look at the, from what I understand of what they're doing, that what they want to do in your state is they want to cut the maximum benefit by a third. They want to cut the number of weeks from 26 down to 20, and I'd even seen almost down to 13. And I think about all of that money that would be going into the local economy, local businesses not getting. And I remember, right in 2008, I had read, an argument back from when they started unemployment insurance that said, look, we want this because businesses need it. Not because they didn't care about the workers. They wanted it because businesses needed the demand. They needed consumers. They needed people to be walking in their door.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it has been missed here so far. I mean, the Chamber of Commerce, and it appears to us to be a national effort by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and North Carolina's following that playbook, is to really dismantle the unemployment insurance system. And I think a lot of it is to have a very desperate workforce. It will then you'll have a labor market that people will work for almost anything at this point. And it's also ideological. I mean, I think there's a real belief that unemployment insurance is like welfare. And we've seen quite often over the last couple of years people who are out of work being portrayed as folks who just want to sit home and watch TV and don't want to work.
Yeah, we've got a governor.
Thing from the strike.
Yeah, we've got a governor who said that they're lazy. You know, people are lazy. They don't want to work, which is nonsense. I know people who they're out there every day trying to find a job, and they're just not there. Sorry, just not there.
Well, and the data is there for people that care to look at the facts, and that we have lost hundreds and hundreds of thousands of jobs in North Carolina, and there's three workers for every available job. And so you can cut unemployment. You can reduce the number of weeks down to 12 if you want. You can reduce the amount of benefits from $525, which is the maximum, and cut it down to $350. None of that will change the fact that these people are out of work, there aren't the jobs, and they're not going to have the resources to make ends meet. And that's not going to change that fact at all.
You know, to me, Bill, this is just another one of the components of the whole what I call the no rights at work agenda that the right wing in this country is trying to go after. Gutting labor laws, wanting to go after these so-called right to work for less laws, repeal Davis-Bacon, wanting to destroy health and safety laws, going after, obviously, unemployment, workers' comp, pensions, health care, family leave, whatever, contraception, whatever, minimum wage, all of this stuff. It's all to destroy working conditions in this country and to have desperate workers, basically a slave class, if you will.
And unfortunately, that appears to be the case. And I mean, in North Carolina, we've had our tough times with an anti-labor agenda for generations here. And our good friends at the AFL-CIO and the other unions work hard to organize and to be a force. But we have some of the least union density in the country, and we are a right-to-work state. And it just amazes us that you would turn your sights on unemployment benefits as somewhere where you're going to get more out of the system. It's really coming down to that the employers don't want to pay any more in unemployment insurance taxes. And even though their contribution rate, currently anyway, per employee, we rank 30th in the country. So they're doing much better, and they're screaming about the taxes that they have right now, but they're not anywhere near even the middle of the pack. But the balance is they're going to do it by just not paying a penny, and in fact, a tax cut for employers and taking the rest of it out of hard work families who are struggling to make ends meet.
Well, how much of it is just pure and simple redistribution of wealth, taking it from working class folks and giving it to the very top of the... I mean, you look at what's gone over the last 30 years. We have created the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization. And how's that happened? By doing exactly what they're doing with the unemployment comp, by doing what they've done with labor laws and shifting the ability of workers to be able to exist or survive. And paying homage to the top.
And what's very insidious here about all of this is that it's a 50-page bill. It's very complicated. When it was trotted out in committee, it's a PowerPoint with just a few bullets and does not go into detail. And constantly the scripted presentation is this is fair, this is balanced, there's a little bit of pain here for everybody. But when you start to look into it and dive down in and look at the numbers, you see that's not true, even though it keeps being repeated over and over again.
I'm sorry, you can repeat their shared pain in this. When you're talking about cutting a third of the benefit and cutting the number of weeks from 26 down to the one number I saw down from to 20 to 12
it
on a sliding
scale. The 12 could be, depending on the it will be a sliding scale based on the unemployment rate for the state. And that could go as low as 12 weeks as our maximum benefit.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not seeing the shared sacrifice. I'm seeing the pain at the bottom.
Yeah. I mean, it's absurd. And it's our hope here is to keep getting the message out, getting information in front of the press. The press has been picking up on it and digging into it and putting it out there. Our problem is political in some ways because the General Assembly is now completely controlled by one party, the Republicans, and we have a new governor who is also a Republican, and it just remains to be seen whether they are going to try and be fair about this process, or it's just they can literally do whatever they want, to be honest with you.
They can do like here in Pennsylvania, steamroll through whatever they want.
That's right. And we're hoping there's going to be some public outcry. I mean, they're already hearing it from folks. But whether it will matter or not, I don't know. But we're hopeful that it will because it's so absurd and it's so injurious to folks that we're hoping that there's maybe some shame left out there somewhere in the state where folks won't be going down this path.
You know, Bill, the more I look at this, the more I, like you, I keep looking for that outrage because, you know, I know folks who have been unemployed and we all know somebody who's lost a job because of the jobs crisis. We all know someone who's been out of work and, you know, I'm sorry. You know, I empathize with these folks and I think we should have government policy to help them, not demonize them, not call them names, call them lazy or stupid or shiftless or any of that stuff. We should be doing things to, A, make it a little easier on them and help them get a job.
That's right. I mean,
does this do anything? This assault on workers, unemployment comp, does this do anything to get people a job and get back to work?
Not that we can see in this bill. There's some things that ought to be done because there is a disconnect between the skill sets of a lot of workers, especially older workers and in some of our parts of the state and some of the jobs that may be coming down the pike or that are here now. And something does need to be done to make sure that they can get the training and get the skills to get those jobs. But in fact, this bill would make it you wouldn't be able to get that training and still collect unemployment benefits. If some job came along that offered the minimum wage job, you'd have to take it. You'd have to leave the training you were in or the program you were in to try and get that skill set to take that part-time job or that minimum wage job. And so it's counterintuitive to the whole point that we really do need to build up the skill set for a lot of our workforce who have been in manufacturing for generations that are now been left behind and need to get the training, but we're not going to give them the time or the opportunity. We're going to force them to take a job at Walmart or take a part-time job somewhere else if there's one there, and not get the skills that they need.
Here again, this looks to me to be short-sighted, punitive, and just dumb policy. And again, you know, I go back to 2010 when on the national level, Republicans took over the House, and they had their little pledge and their little colored booklet with the 27 pages of smiling white people and some flowery language. And they talked about laser-like focus, jobs, jobs, jobs. Yet I have seen nothing that creates any jobs. I've seen nothing. I've seen a lot of pointing fingers. I've seen a lot of demonizing working people, but nothing to help.
Yeah, and I again, and it goes beyond the unemployment situation here. It's just how are we going to create jobs? And the only thing that we've seen so far, and our legislature hasn't started to meet yet, but what's been talked about is just tax reform, which mainly translates to tax cuts and some circles and some prominent circles in the legislature. They're talking about eliminating our corporate income tax and our personal income tax.
Nice.
And that's the way to put money in the job producers, creators' pockets. And so we'll be creating jobs, which we know that is not the case and it will not work. But that's, again, the mantra that sort of the bill of goods being sold right now, that if we just cut taxes, we'll be able to create jobs.
Well, at least they're not making the argument that at least you'd be able to steal jobs from Virginia or steal jobs from South Carolina, because that's the argument they make in other states. Hey, if we go to the bottom of the barrel, we can steal from other people.
Well, I hate to say it, but North Carolina, that's generally been our modus operandi, and we do talk about how we want to be able to compete against South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, some states that we generally didn't want to compete with because they were at the lowest end of the bottom of the barrel in terms of the health of the community and the people who live in those places. But right now the current discussion is how we compete with those places. And so that's our unemployment insurance system. I mean, the reason we're reducing our maximum weekly benefit amount is what they've done is just average the southern states' maximum benefit amount, decided it was $350. And so that's what it will be. Disregarding that our maximum benefit amount has always been tied to what the average weekly wage in North Carolina was, and it was about a two-thirds replacement of that. So it's just picking, you know, between a lot of states where it's very low and then averaging it, saying that's what ours will be then.
At the end of it, it's still a ripoff for working people, and I'm hoping that there'll be some outrage. I'm hoping that there'll be some blowback and that you guys do, you're able to push back on this.
There has been, and you know, we had some workers be heard at last committee meeting in December, and it's one of the few times where workers do get heard, and I think it was powerful and effective, and it's probably the best thing that can happen is for workers to come forward and talk about it. These were unemployed folks who had all different manner of stories, but you couldn't accuse them of being lazy, and you have to look them in the eye if you're going to do these things and tell them what you're about to do. But they weren't going to do it that day, so we'll see. It's going to come up.
And my hope is this becomes an organizing opportunity where working people wake up and smell the roses and say, you know what, we've got to come together and we've got to fight for a more progressive, a better future and push back against this no rights at work agenda. Bill Rowe, I appreciate the time. Best of luck. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Listening to the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service. 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right. And you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Such energy powers as BP, ExxonMobil, Halliburton, and Koch Industries have gone crackers over fracking. Seeing huge profits from this dreadfully destructive and dangerously dirty method of forcing natural gas out of rock formations deep in the earth, the industry is presently stirring all over the country, asking landowners to sign contracts, allowing them to drill and frack on farms, parkland, playgrounds, and even people's backyards. But now, in cities and rural areas alike, this unbridled gas rush has become a matter of deeply grave concern. Literally, in the shriveled ethical universe of these fracking profiteers, money trumps everything, and nothing is sacred. Not even graveyards. The eternal resting place of our loved ones. Yes, gas frackers across the country are out to get drilling rights in hundreds of cemeteries, promising maintenance money to caretakers in exchange for letting the corporations sink their explosive siphons down under the dearly departed. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, and mineral rights to Exxon. How spiritual. Oh, come on, snapped the industry's impatient hustlers. The fracking takes place way underground, so it won't disturb the graves. Yeah, but what about the souls? A cemetery is a spiritual sanctuary, a place of respect, serenity, and moral decorum. But a fracking corporation has no soul, and its moral concerns penetrate no deeper than its bottom line. For a measure of just how shallow corporate morality is, note that the frackers even threaten the hallowed ground of some of our veterans' cemeteries. Their ethos is clear. Hey, out of the way. Decorum is one thing, but there's money under those graves. This is Jim Hightower saying they're fracturing our deepest values. To fight this, go to foodandwaterwatch.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out. HightowerLowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, download the podcast there from the website or get the Stitcher app. Stitcher on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Give me a call. Thoughts, questions, comments, something on your mind. You know, I look at this, and in talking with Bill Rowe, the director of advocacy at the North Carolina Justice Center, about this whole another part of this no rights at work agenda that the right is trying to ram down our throat, the destruction of unemployment compensation benefits, wage insurance. Is what it really is. It's so that there's money left in the economy when the bottom falls out, so it doesn't free fall. As bad as September, October, November, December of 2008, January, February, March of 2009 were, we were still buoyed up by the fact that we had these elastic programs that made sure that there was still money there. There was still some consumer capabilities. There was still demand. And that we didn't free fall to the bottom and everything grind to a screeching halt. Which is, you know, if you listen to the Pat Toomeys and you listen to some of the far out conservative right wingers, that's what they wanted, the harder down, the collapse. And think about what that would have meant for you and me. Think about what that would have meant for working people. The wealth class, they want that. Yeah, they lose a little bit of their wealth now, but you know what? They make it through just fine, thank you very much. Because then they get to buy everything up. And look what they're going to start doing with the housing market right now. We're going to start bundling up whole hundreds of houses and say, here, investors, buy them up. Pennies on the dollar. And then you can go rent them back to those people who had the dream that someday they may own. That they may own that house. It's mind-blowing. And you look at, it's really breathtaking when you stop and look at what this proposal is. And I know here in Pennsylvania, it didn't get any media coverage, really. Other than our program, I don't think anyone really talked about the unemployment compensation bill that the Republicans rammed through here, which is going to freeze benefits for the next decade so that those benefits are going to be eroded by inflation. And it gave a huge tax cut to employers who had been getting years of tax cuts off of the unemployment compensation insurance, and gave you and me, the taxpayers of the Commonwealth, well, gave us the bill, $3.5 billion. You and I, we did that. We got stuck with that. So another huge tax cut for the corporations, diminished benefits for the workers, and the bill. What a beautiful system. And now they want to do the exact same thing, only maybe a little bit worse, if you will. They want to cut the benefits by 33% down there in North Carolina and reduce the number of weeks down to as low as 12 weeks of unemployment. Now, we've seen people I know people who've been unemployed 99 weeks. I know people who've gone to the end, and they still can't find a job. They're working day work here and there, trying to make ends meet. And still, no policy. No policy coming out of Harrisburg. No policy coming out of Washington, D.C. No investment. No jobs bills. Unless you buy, like Bill Rowe pointed out, their jobs bill, doing away with the income tax, the corporate tax rate, doing away with income tax. That's it. Starve government even further. Take away the ability to react to crisis even more. Somehow that's going to work. And, oh, by the way, we need to compete. I loved what he said. North Carolina is now competing with Alabama and Mississippi. And understand, if you look at the unemployment compensation rates, the weekly rates for people in Mississippi, $235 a week, the lowest in the country. Louisiana, $247 a week, the third lowest. Alabama, $265 a week, the fourth lowest. Florida, $275 a week, the fifth lowest. Do you know what the lowest unemployment insurance compensation rates in the country have in common? All five of them are right-to-work states. And you stop and look at the states who have the higher replacement rates. Places like Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New Jersey, here in Pennsylvania. Go ahead, you can say it. None. No rights at work states. And I ask my workforce, my working friends, does that not throw up some red flags? Does that not shake you awake and say that what the right is trying to do is drag us all down to the likes of Mississippi or Alabama? Instead of saying, hey, Mississippi and Alabama, we're going to pull you up. We're going to all do better. What we've got in this country, people saying we all need to do worse. We all need to go down. We all need to make conditions worse. That's what they're telling us. And it should infuriate and anger every person who punches a clock or collects a paycheck. That all they've done is they've got us pointing fingers at each other. And they've done it extremely effectively. It's mind-blowing. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, going to talk about a little bit about Chris Christie's rant yesterday. Was it real? Was it feigned? Is he going to let a good crisis go to waste? I don't think so. Right back after this. Stick around.
Me and my people are ready. Me and my people are just about due. I'm a man.
Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Earth, sky.
Maybe you've heard somewhere about planet Nibiru. This Nibiru, which has made a big splash on the internet, will supposedly collide with Earth in 2012.
Which, while interesting, is not true. There is no planet Nibiru. There's not the slightest trace of a ripple of it anywhere near Earth, or anywhere else in our solar system.
The claim is that it's a large world, around the size of the giant planets Jupiter and Saturn, with an orbital period of 3,600 years. If that were so, Nibiru should be inside Jupiter's orbit by now. Dazzling Jupiter, the fifth planet outward from our sun, is impossible to miss with the unaided eye. In fact, you can even view Jupiter's four major moons with ordinary binoculars. But no Nibiru.
Some claim that Nibiru was closest to Earth between August 17th and September 26th. If it was, no one saw it.
We have a great video at EarthSky.org, courtesy of David Morrison, senior scientist at the NASA Astrobiology Institute at NASA Ames Research Center in California. In the video, Morrison explains why there's simply no Nibiru. He says he hopes the non-arrival of Nibiru will serve as a teaching moment for the public on, quote, rational thought and baloney detection.
See the video and learn who originated the idea of a planet called Nibiru at EarthSky.org. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
They believe in teachers' unions. We believe in teachers.
What do they do? They smile in your face. All the time they want to take your place. The backstabbers. Backstabbers.
I'm Chris Christie believes in, yes, he believes in teachers. Oh, yeah, you bet your bottom dollar on that. Just like he's angry at Republicans. I got to be honest. Yesterday we were talking about it. I was going, yeah, you know, that's funny listening to him rail against Republicans, but it's all feigned. He just wants the money. It's that simple. Give me the money. And he even said that. Someone asked him, well, you're mad at the Republicans? Yeah, until they give me money, then I'll reconsider. Pretty simple. It's politics. And there's part of me that goes, this is the 2016 presidential election heating up already. Anyway, the 112th Congress gaveled to a close this afternoon without passing the relief package that Christie wanted, and helping the victims of Hurricane Sandy. They also failed to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act. They failed to address the jobs crisis, do anything to fix our crumbling infrastructure. But what did they do? Well, nothing. They let it go out. And they decided what's really important, and they let my girl Michelle Bachmann have the honors at exactly 12 p.m. this afternoon, the honor and the privilege of introducing the very first piece of legislation of this 113th Congress, the most important thing to Republicans, you know, their priorities. Well, repeal the Affordable Care Act. Got to get rid of Obamacare. Very first thing that should be done according to them. Now, I understand Republicans have voted 33 times unsuccessfully, I might add, over the last couple of years to deny people the right of health care. But to them, 34 might be the charm. Screw those people in New York and New Jersey. and so much for they care about taxpayers' dollars, because they've wasted nearly 90 hours of time on the House floor and squandered in excess of $50 million. And still, the people of New York and New Jersey, nothing. And you've got an outraged governor. Here to help me go through what the governor had to say, I've asked Jersey Jazzman, a blogger from New Jersey who follows what goes on there very closely, to come talk to us about the governor's outrage, and will he use this crisis to do much like they did in Louisiana and public schools as we know it? Jersey, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, my pleasure, Rick. Thanks for having me back on. Always like coming here.
I appreciate you taking time. You know, I looked at his speech yesterday. He had a lot of liberals going, oh, look at Chris Christie taking them to task. And I'm going, it's just BS. It's political theater. He's mad he didn't get his money.
It really makes me kind of nuts. I have to say this, to have people on the left be so snookered by this. I mean, first of all, the guy's just doing his job. I mean, have we hit the point now where a guy stands up and he does his job and we all swoon and fall over the place? Of course he's supposed to advocate for the state. That's his job. So, you know, to say all of a sudden that he's having this miraculous turnaround or he's suddenly seen light, it's ridiculous. And it, on top of which, he's going after John Boehner. Is there a more unpopular guy in America than John Boehner right now? I can't possibly think of who it might be. Maybe Andy Reid. I mean, you know.
Maybe Jerry Sandusky.
Possibly. There you go. Why are we thinking football? I don't know. I mean, going after Boehner is no big deal. And on top of which, even the base hates Boehner now. I mean, the base hates Boehner, from what I understand, because he actually voted to go along with the compromise bill. So all of a sudden, the wing nuts don't even like the guy. So everything that Chris Christie does is a political calculation. And for me, the best way to think about Chris Christie is to think about where he came from. And this guy made his bones in the Bush administration in Karl Rove's Justice Department. He was a U.S. attorney. He was one of the star pupils that Rove had in terms of taking that office and politicizing it. You know, he went after Bob Menendez, our senator, famously, like 2 weeks, I think, before the election. You know, there's all kinds of stories about favoritism, particularly involving his brother, Todd Christie. So, you know, he comes out of the Bush way of thinking, and who better than George W. Bush to exploit a crisis or to show us how to exploit a crisis. This was a guy, every time anybody pointed at his economic failure, and as far as I'm concerned, he's the greatest failure, certainly of my lifetime, to ever sit in the White House. Anytime anybody pointed to that, the first thing out of his mouth was 9/11.
Yep.
Anytime that Chris Christie runs into an economic problem, I guarantee you, Rick, write it down right now, the first thing out of his mouth will be Sandy.
Absolutely.
He is going to use this to push through as radical of an agenda as you could possibly imagine in a deep blue state like New Jersey. And I think even more importantly, he's going to use Sandy as his excuse. It's going to be the way that he covers up his own failures, because things were starting to come to a head here. And in fact, they're coming to a head very fast. Things are not going well for this state. The unemployment rate is not good. Atlantic City was taking a huge hit even before Sandy. He had invested all of this money in this Revel casino, all of these tax breaks, and it's turned out to be a flop. I don't see it turning around anytime soon. You know, our infrastructure is falling apart. There's been inadequate funding for schools. All of these serious problems that he has not addressed, he needs an excuse, and Mother Nature gave him one, and boy, he's going to ride it for everything it's worth.
He's going to milk it for everything it's worth, and not to mention, he needs that money, because a whole ton of federal money coming into your state will smooth over a lot of things, I think.
Well, I mean, there's no question about that. He's lost out on a significant amount of federal money prior to this. We had this new tunnel that was going to connect the state to Manhattan, the ARC tunnel, and he basically screwed that up and turned it down because he wasn't going to follow through on his commitment to provide the funding. That would have been a huge economic boost to the state, and basically, you know, that's gone.
And something the area desperately needed as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, we're a bedroom community. And in the South, we're a bedroom community, obviously, to Philly. And in the North, we're a bedroom community to New York. The more that you do to facilitate transportation between those two major metropolitan areas and New Jersey, the better off it is for our state.
Yep.
But our infrastructure is just absolutely crumbling. There is report and after report about how our roads, our bridges are really suffering. And, you know, to be fair, it's bad all over. It's bad all over the country. But in New Jersey, a densely populated state, to have these problems, it's pretty serious. But there's something else coming that, to me, it was really interesting that you were talking about before this, about unemployment in Pennsylvania not being indexed to inflation. Did I get that right?
Yeah, not only did they not index it, they have frozen it from 2010 levels until 2019.
Right.
So it's going to be eaten away by inflation because it's not going up.
That's fascinating to me. And you must be the only one who's reported it. Not that, you know, I'm an expert on Pennsylvania politics, but it's fascinating to me because in 2011, Christie worked out a pension deal with conservative Democrats here. And part of the deal was to freeze inflation indexes, cost of living increases, for current retirees, not even future retirees, current public employee retirees.
Wow.
This was, to me, probably the worst part of the deal, certainly the most reprehensible. I mean, to take, you know, working cops, working firefighters, working teachers, people who worked hard their whole life, and then to basically break your promise to them, I thought was, you know, just absolutely horrible. And then in addition to that, we saw pension increases come on public employees. What he did was walk around the state arm in arm with Steve Sweeney, who eventually
a Democrat.
Democratic leader of the Senate. They had a falling out soon enough. But at the time, he walked around the state bragging about how he had saved our finance. What he had done was just kick the can down the road. And anybody with a lick of common sense knew this. Unfortunately, we don't have a media that has a lot of those people in it. So you got a lot of, oh, isn't Chris Christie wonderful? All he did was defer the pension payment so that he didn't have to make a full one until 2018. It basically goes up by a seventh every year. Next year he's going to have to come up with about $1.5 billion. I don't see any way he's going to do that. But then in 2018 he's got to come up somewhere around $3.5 billion to $4 billion. He's got to come up with that money. And if he doesn't come up with it, the union's won the right to sue. So where is he going to get this money? Well, the first thing he did was cut taxes on wealthy people when he came into office.
Right.
Cut them by about $600 million. He tried to pull state school aid away from his political base in the suburbs. That didn't work. Then he tried to pull it away from the cities. The courts forced him to put it back. He's running out of places to get money from. Where's he going to get it? It's obvious to me that Sandy is his answer. He's going to use Sandy, and again, mark my words on this, and we'll give it a year or two, and we'll see if I'm right about this.
I guarantee you're right.
He's going to use Sandy. He's going to turn to the pension system, and he's going to say, I can't afford to make the payments that I promised I was going to make. Public workers, even though you already took it on the chin once before, now I'm going to give you the real royal screwing that I've been wanting to give you since the very beginning, and Sandy is going to be the excuse that he's going to use to do it.
Yeah, and have you gone to the, we need to push for a defined contribution plan so people, state workers have 401ks, because that's what they're doing here in Pennsylvania, because they've done, here in Pennsylvania, we've already done what Christie's done, not made contributions to the pension fund. In fact, for years, for nearly a decade, they made no contributions whatsoever and gave those away in tax breaks for employers. So now that the system needs money, now they're saying, well, we need to have a defined contribution plan, even though that's not going to solve the problem. And actually, it's going to make it worse, but it's ideological the way we need to go.
Yeah, you know, I have not heard that from him, and my theory on that is this. The only thing holding the pensions up right now are the current contributions. If you allowed people, even just the people who had invested, I think you vest in, the teachers vest in 10 years here in New Jersey. I'm counting down to my day. Even if you told the people, just the people who had invested, you can pull out and you don't have to contribute anymore, the entire thing is going to collapse like a house of cards. They're not getting much money off of the market right now. So, and in fact, the projections that they've based up for the future are ridiculous. I think that they are counting on 8.25% coming back from their investments. You know, there's just no way that's going to happen. But what do I know? I'm not a Wall Street guy. It just seems crazy to me. If you told current employees that you could pull out and not pay, where would you come up with the money to pay for current retirees? I don't know where they would get that money. So I don't even think that he's going to put that on the table. Again, though, I think you make a good point, Rick. Sometimes what seems to be logical is the thing that they don't do just because they are so bound to their ideology and they're willing to put their heads in the sand. Now, Christie tries to paint himself as a moderate, as somebody who doesn't do that. But at the end of the day, you know, he does have national ambitions. There's no question about that.
Sure.
He's going to have to play this ideological game, and so he'll probably put something, in front of the workers. And you're right, it'll be a disaster if he does.
Well, let me ask you this last line of questioning I've got for you. And it's kind of a big topic. I mean, here in this state, they're talking about privatizing everything, hocking everything off, privatizing the wine and spirit shops, the lottery, the turnpike, the pensions. I'm sure are going to come down the road that we need to privatize that and get it into Wall Street. Our education system, they've been full force trying to privatize and profitize. Will he use Sandy as a greater excuse to do more privatization like they did with Katrina in Louisiana, where they were able to, in New Orleans, basically wipe public education off the map and privatize the whole thing?
Now, that's a great question. And obviously it's still too early to tell because it's only been a couple of months. What has happened in New Jersey over the last couple of years, and I can speak in particular to schools because that's mostly what I do on my blog, they have put in a structure that is surprisingly like the recovery school district down in Louisiana. It's a centralized structure that takes away local power, takes away the power of the school boards, takes away the power of the parents to be involved in the decisions and the local taxpayers to be involved in the decisions about their schools, particularly within the city. There was some movement to do this in the suburbs. They backed off of it because they realized that's Christie's base and that if he loses the suburbs, there's no way he gets reelected as governor. There's actually been talk at the Department of Education of creating a statewide school district that is very similar to the recovery school district down in Louisiana, where you're taking schools, you're marking them as being in need of improvement. The term they use is a priority school. And part of the remedy for that is to flip it over into a charter. Right now, New Jersey has a law that says you can't run a charter as a for-profit, but all you have to do is set up a nonprofit shell.
Right.
That's what's happening in Newark right now. K-12, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and God knows Pennsylvania has had a nightmare with these blended learning, these cyber schools. K-12 just made inroads to get into Newark. They are big backers of Mayor Cory Booker. They are coming in and establishing a school under a shell, a nonprofit shell, but really it's a for-profit company. They have big ambitions. I look at the places that were hit by Sandy hard, and I think that districts like Atlantic City and Asbury Park, which are right on the shore, they are primed for this sort of stuff to sort of seep out of Newark and come into the other cities. So I think it's a very good point, and privatization of schools could be following from this. You know, there's a big rebuilding that needs to be done, and if people can get their hands on that and rebuild these schools into charter schools instead of actual public schools, we already have the precedent for this in Camden. There's a plot of public land called Landing Squared, which has basically been turned over to the Kip Charter School chain under the aegis of George Norcross, who's the Democratic boss down there. They are taking this land that was promised to the people of Camden. They're giving it to a charter school. There's no guarantee that charter school is going to serve all the kids in Camden. There's your model right there.
Yep.
And there's no reason, I think, that that couldn't be replicated in places that have been hit hard by Sandy, like Perth Amboy, like Asbury Park, like Atlantic City, places that were, you know, have significant numbers of poor families and, you know, have schools that are really in need of assistance. It's a shame. Because
New
Jersey schools are it's the crown jewel of the state. It's the thing we should be most proud of.
Absolutely. And the thing is, you brought up that the law says they're nonprofit. Doesn't mean that they can't use for-profit companies to provide them with the curriculum and all of the other stuff that they're going to profit off of anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what they did in Chester Uplands, right?
Absolutely.
You know, so, I mean, it's almost like we are... You know, I've been hearing these stupid cliff analogies all week, but we are right on the cliff. We have seen all of these things happening all over the country that all it's going to take is one push and everything else is going to fall. And it's almost like this is the last stand. If we really care about saving public schools, this is where we need to put our foot down. And I have to say, Rick, and I know you've talked about what's happened in Chicago. God bless Karen Lewis. God bless the Chicago Teachers Union.
Yep.
That's the sort of stuff that we got to start having all over the country.
Boots
we got to have
street.
Tough-minded union leaders standing up and saying, enough is enough. We are not going to let our great public schools fall into the hands of these pirates.
Well, this is what I've been telling people for the last couple of years. Look, this is the hill we die on. Education, public education is the hill we have to die on, because once that goes away, everything else goes with it.
I absolutely agree, and it's not just in terms of the jobs of the teachers. It's in terms of what kind of country we're going to be. We've got enough data on these charter schools right now. We know they segregate. We know this now. It's not even subject to a debate. So if we want to have a society where it really is a real meritocracy, where you can be born poor, but if you're talented and you're hardworking, you can change your entire life. We've got to have an equitable education system. If we allow this public education system to become segregated by class, segregated by language, segregated by educational need, and yes, it pains me to say this, but segregated by race as well. We are seeing this over and over again. If we allow this to happen, I really fear for the future of this country. So I'm with you, brother. This has got to be the last stand. And, you know, all of us, you know, whether we're in the labor movement, whether we're educators, whether we're just concerned citizens, this is where we got to stand up and say enough is enough, or we're going to be in some real trouble.
Well, I mean, the areas that you pointed out, most people would think are kind of inner city areas, Newark, Camden. Most people that I talk to in my neighborhood say, "Wow, that's an inner city. That's an urban area." And if you go back to the presidential election, you know, Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan say, "Well, it was the urbans that did it. It was those urban people." Pretty much making that dividing line between, you know, rural and urban, saying, "Well, those charter schools are only going to be there." And I keep telling my friends who live in rural areas, trust me, when they're done blueprinting the model there, it's coming here. Profit in education is all around, and they're going to suck every dime out of it.
It's, you know, I'm at this stage in my life right now. I was a little melancholy because my oldest son is a senior in high school, and I was just accepted to college, you know, his first choice in college, and I'm seeing what public education did for this nearly young man. You know, it's almost a man. And what New Jersey schools did for him, what New Jersey schools did for his brother, and we're on the cusp of losing that. It's not just the opportunities. There's all the cultural things involved. You want to give up Friday night football games? You want to give up the PTO? You want to give up having your town pride be invested in your town school? Is that what we really want in this country? It's such a part of the fabric of who we are. So,
Well, the problem with Jersey is this whole commodification of education, where it's just a commodity. It's not what makes us critical thinkers and whole people. It's just a commodity to get us a job.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and that has been going on for a good long while. Of course, you can trace it back to A Nation at Risk in, you know, the 1980s. But in fact, Paul Thomas, who does a lot of blogging on education, actually pointed out the other day on his blog, this has actually been going on for 100 years. The difference, as far as I'm concerned, is that we used to have a strong labor movement in this country that stood up to this. And we've seen this becoming more and more eroded over the years. That's got to stop. We have got to keep these labor unions strong. Because we're finding out, and again, Chicago is a great example of this, that a strong teachers union can stand up for the kids where other people just don't have the power or just don't have the will. The notion that the interests of teachers unions are antithetical to the interests of children play right into the hands of the people who really want to dismantle public education and take it over for themselves. That's really part of the game plan, and we can't allow that to happen. So, again, my call is not just for teachers to stand up and parents and everyone else. We need for the unions to stand up. We need for them to stand up and start getting involved, and they are, and when they do, they should be applauded for that. I strongly, strongly support them standing up and putting the interest of public education first.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. You know, because I got to be honest, I lived through the whole era of busing in this country, and that was a failure then. All of these silver bullets where they keep trying to sell us on this on a newfangled model of how we're going to save education only ends up destroying it and making it that much worse.
Yeah, it comes and goes like pet rocks or something. Yeah. You know, there's always something around the corner that's going to be the new thing. I do think there's something new in this sort of round, though, and it's betrayed by the fact that so much of it is being pushed by the wealthiest people in this country. I mean, it's not just even like corporate interest now. I mean, we are talking the very wealthiest people in this country, Bill Gates, Michael Bloomberg, Eli Broad, Rupert Murdoch. These are folks with enormous piles of money, the Walton family. And yet, they have involved themselves in education. Now, some of the reason for that, some of them are looking to make money, but I really think the larger reason for that is ideological.
And it's about power and control.
Yeah. And it's about sending a message, too. It's about sending a message about, you know, how this country is going to be run. And, again, this is it. This is our chance to stand on the hill and say, you know, enough's enough. So hopefully, we're going to be doing that in New Jersey over the next couple of years. And hopefully Governor Christie is going to be a one-term governor. But given the popularity of this last exchange, whoever is the Democrat who takes him on, it's going to be a tough fight.
Yeah, well, as this goes on, I'd love to have you back again. The website, jerseyjazzman.blogspot.com. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Jersey Jazzman's name. It'll take you right there. It's always great talking with you. Love to have you back.
I appreciate it, man. Thanks so much. It very much. I appreciate what you're doing. Keep doing what you're doing, brother.
Thanks so much. Quick break. Back with hour three of the program. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
United we bargain, divided we mend. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. The Senate compromise on the so-called fiscal cliff will in many ways act as a band-aid, passing a number of issues created by the current Congress onto the next Congress. The massive spending cuts, known as the sequester, will be delayed for 2 months. In order to cover some of the costs, there will be discretionary cuts in both defense and welfare programs. The payroll tax holiday will expire, resulting in a 2% increase in payroll taxes. The debt ceiling wasn't touched at all in the fiscal patch. A farm bill that had long been languishing in Congress will see a 9-month extension. If that bill had not been pushed through, milk prices could have doubled or tripled in 2013, with some regions of the country paying as much as $8 per gallon. The bill failed to include disaster relief funds for those still recovering from the impact of Superstorm Sandy. It also doesn't solve the issue of spending cuts creating what will undoubtedly be a second fiscal cliff in early March. Some of the other changes include the estate tax being raised to 40% for those above the $400,000 threshold, but also includes an exemption of $5 million. The capital gains tax will be set at 20% for those earning more than $400,000. The Bush-era tax cuts were made permanent for any families with income below $400,000 and individuals under $450,000. Tax rates above that amount will revert to Clinton-era tax rates. Three Democrats broke ranks and voted against the Senate compromise. Iowa Senator Tom Harkin was among them, and he said the bill benefited the wealthiest Americans on the backs of the poor.
Wisconsin's Mark Pocan is one of the new freshman crop of U.S. House members coming into Congress in 2013. Pocan says there will be plenty of unfinished economic business for the new Congress to wade into, and he's hoping for a new posture and attitude in the new U.S. House despite it still being in Republican control. Pocan made it clear that his vote will be opposed to Social Security and Medicare cuts as Congress works its way through fiscal issues.
And there's talks about benefit cuts, and you know, I think those programs are just so valuable and they're so popular, that's not where we should be looking. But you know, I also think I want to add to those programs for protecting also things that just, you know, help the most vulnerable. You know, they really can't afford anymore, and I think we really have to make sure we're doing this in a very smart way. So I'm hoping that the conversations, I'm seeing many people on both sides of the aisle start to have a more reasonable tone. I haven't quite seen it from the Republican leadership yet, but I'm seeing it from some of the Republican members, and I think that's a very positive trend.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
I gotta tell you, I love that doomsday. That's one of the things I love about the Republicans. It's always the 24 mentality, the end of the world, the fiscal cliff. Oh, if we go over, it's the end of the world. And we've got to do this now, and it's got to be in the dark of night, and it's got to be ticking down to the last second. And what do you end up with? You end up with, and I still want to know why 85 Republicans voted for it. What handouts did they get? What is it in it that we don't know? I know a lot of the corporate handouts. I know keeping the profits offshore, that's sacrosanct. Can't look at that. I know tax breaks for rum producers and NASCAR, that had to stay too, but tax increases for you and me, we can do that. I want to know what's in it. This is a bad deal from start to go, in my opinion. That's why I've asked Gaius Publius, contributing editor at americablog.com, to come talk to us about his thoughts on the deal. Gaius, thanks for taking time for me.
How you doing?
I'm good. So, you know, in your opinion, good, bad? What do you think?
Well, you know, I listened to your intro, and you make me proud. Yes, I think it's a bad deal myself.
Because I want to know why 85 Republicans who signed the Grover Norquist pledge, we're never raising taxes, the end of the world could happen, never, why'd they vote for it?
Well, there's a split within the Republican Party between the corporatists who say all the right things because of they signed the Norquist pledge, and the people who are more hardcore hardliners. And the people who are basically corporatists, there was enough corporate sweet stuff in this deal that you mentioned some of it, but there's offshore havens have been protected, and the White House actually made those things go in. Some of the Republicans didn't want them in. That's the first thing that the Republicans really, really like about this. The second thing is that they got the sequester extended for 2 months. That's about the time that the debt ceiling blow-up is going to occur, and they're going to take another run at Social Security and Medicare. So they are licking their chops on this one.
Yeah, and to me, and a guy named Charles Blow, he had an op-ed today in the New York Times. You know, he likened it to an Escher drawing. All of these cliffs, cliff after cliff, likened it, and I like the analogy of an Escher drawing one into the other and constant and continual, where it's always this constant crisis situation, the ticking bomb, the end of the world's coming. And I think it's designed, because Republicans, they want to destroy government. I mean, they're pretty open about that. They want us just to throw up our hands and go, oh, it's all broken. They're all criminals. They're all no good. Government can do nothing. We need to turn to private corporations to do away with the pain. At least that's my thought on it.
Well, I think you're right. There's a wing within the Democratic Party that also has those thoughts. Not the thoughts about
your DLC Democrats.
Private corporate. Sorry?
Your DLC corporate
your
Democrats.
Your DLC types, right. So one of the things that the progressive groups have been doing, I've been part of that process, is to make sure that Democrats stay strong for Democratic principles, which I know you support as well. And, you know, it's just going to be one battle after another against the corporatists in the Republican Party and the corporatists in the Democratic Party to make sure that we don't end up with a bad deal. You know, this is kind of a half-okay deal, and it's got a bad deal aspect to it. The really bad deal is coming down the road, and it's going to be a fight.
And I think you're right. I think you know, the fact that the president did signal that he would be willing to look at a chain CPI for Social Security and looked at some of those things kind of scares me.
Yeah, it should. And in 2011, he offered up extending the Medicare retirement age for 2 years. That's actually going to kill people. Matt Stoller, whom I think his article you might have referenced in your intro, has done a calculation on how many people will actually die if you extend the Medicare retirement age, Medicare eligibility age. That was talked about in the middle of these discussions, by the way, before they went back to Social Security.
Yeah, but I don't think they care. I mean, the reality is they've drank the austerity Kool-Aid, where they've bought the idea that if we suck money out of the economy, we're saving money. It doesn't matter if there's all these negative effects. And you looked at the IMF guy today who published the report who said, oh, well, we screwed up our calculation. We thought every dollar we pulled out of the economy would only cost us 50 cents. Turned out it was a buck and a half, which is why we've seen another recession in Europe, which is why we're seeing all of this pain and suffering through austerity. But, hey, we've got a Republican Party and some Democrats hell-bent on austerity here. And trust me. Cuts to Social Security, cuts to Medicare. That's austerity, my friend.
If you get the idea, as one could easily do, that the rich are ruling the world for their benefit and everything else is just PR, you might not be far wrong.
Well, I mean, look at the story today. Gerard Depardieu is now a Russian citizen because he doesn't want to pay taxes.
Yes, and he's richer than sin. And his ex-wives are not any too happy with him either for other reasons. But he's decided to go the way of the wealth. And, you know, what's the most I can do for me?
Yeah, and to me, you know, I look at this. We've created this global wealth class. You and I, through the fact that we've accepted crummier jobs, we've allowed them to destroy our ability to collective bargaining. They've destroyed the labor laws. They've destroyed our ability to share in the profits, and they don't want to share.
No, they really don't. And you know that it started actually with Reagan and with that. I don't know if you remember a book called Taking Care of Number One. Coming out of that be conscious of others era, they started to have a selfishness era in the late 70s. Carter is actually a sort of a proto
Boom generation.
Clintonite. Yeah.
I mean, it was the whole people think that, you know, the Vietnam War was about, you know, the left and people wanting to, you know, come together. No, it was about, I don't want to go to Vietnam and die. It was about me.
I will defend, you know, all of the changes that we think of as positive came out of that generation and that era when they were young as well. All of the green, all of the ecology, all of the women's movement, women's rights, all of those things had their birth in that generation as well.
Absolutely, but a lot of it came out of me. And you see people like David Horowitz, who was a big lefty in the 60s, now a big righty. Why? Because it's about me.
Correct. And some people have stayed left and some have moved right. You're exactly right.
So when I look at this, I go, you know, now let's start thinking about this as a society. I read an article today. Someone said, well, Americans aren't collectivists, so that the whole labor union thing and the whole progressive society never going to work. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a battle. We're kind of coming down to the third and fourth quarter of a game that actually has an end. This is not baseball where you can go on forever. There's going to be an end of the game at some point here. And people like you and I are just going to have to keep fighting. And your listeners, I know they listen to you because they care. We're just going to have to keep fighting.
Because my greatest fear is, and you see, earlier in the program we talked to someone from North Carolina, because North Carolina's pursuing another angle of the No Rights at Work agenda, wanting to destroy their unemployment compensation down there, much as we've done here in Pennsylvania and as we've seen across the country. But all of these attacks, all of these things against, you know, minimum wage, against, unemployment, against workers' comp, against safety, health and safety laws, you name it, everything that benefits you and me and other working people, the wealth class of this country wants destroyed.
I would agree with that. And if you're looking for a place to have leverage, I would push you, your readers, your listeners, I would push against the corporate class of the Democrats and start talking to the Tea Party people in the Republicans group, saying, yes, they don't have your principles, but the combination of the Tea Party and the progressives can kill a lot of deals if we can get the two of them working together for entirely different reasons.
Should this deal have been killed?
I would, there's a mixed opinion on that. Me, I think so, yes. I would have killed it. I would have voted against it. If I were in the Senate, I would have denied unanimous consent and gone down in the history of Democratic shame. But I would have made sure it wouldn't have passed. And you could do that with a short deadline, just deny unanimous consent. It takes 3 days to get past unanimous consent.
And what would have happened had we gone over the, well, I know we did go over the proverbial cliff, the mirage that they created for us. We did for a very short time. What would have happened? Would you have been okay with the consequences?
There wouldn't have been consequences.
See, that was my position. I didn't think it was a bluff.
Well, we did go over the cliff, actually. The Bush tax cuts really did expire at midnight, and so did the sequester. And they just figured, you know, your example of an Escher drawing is really, really right, because an Escher drawing is entirely smooth. There are no steep drops. It just goes from one smoothly to the next, smoothly to the next. And that's what this fiscal cliff is. It's not a cliff. It's just somebody drew a chalk line and said, pretend like it's a 5,000-foot drop when, in fact, it's a nothing. And if they want us to fix the sequester, they'll fix the sequester. If they want to reduce taxes, they'll reduce taxes.
Which is why I had been calling it the fiscal mirage the whole time. Because
excellent, yes.
Because they created it, they could have easily uncreated it. All of this stuff was self-imposed. And it was, to me, nonsensical. But it was, in my opinion, it was to get people all worked up because what Republicans and the wealth class understand, and some Democrats, is that we respond to the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy. We respond to fear.
Yep.
We respond to the end of the world, and that's where they keep us politically.
And if you were listening to anybody in the media, that all of the framing was, oh, my God, Cliff, oh, my God, Cliff. I started talking about these people as cliffers because they're basically selling fear of the cliff, and it was all through the news media, even on MSNBC. I would watch Ezra Klein on the Rachel Maddow show coming up the last week before the weekend before Labor Day, between Christmas and New Year's. Sorry, not Labor Day, New Year's. And he was selling, oh my God, Cliff, oh my God, Cliff. It's like they're the carpet bombing before they send in the troops.
Yeah. My problem with all of this is it really didn't do any of the things that I think needed to be done. We've done nothing to help with the folks who are still struggling with the housing crisis. We've done nothing to help people because of a very real jobs crisis. We've done nothing to address really long-term health care. There are a lot of things that just weren't even discussed. But we did do one thing. We made those Bush tax cuts permanent for, what, 99.3% of the population?
Exactly right. And Obama drew a line in the sand that said 250,000, which was already too high. That captures the top 2% and moved it back up again.
Last bit of questioning, because, you know, there are folks who the right, I think, messaging-wise, has done an excellent job of getting, you know, people in the $25,000 to $60,000 income range going, they're raising taxes on me now, but they're going to come for you, and we shouldn't let them raise taxes on anybody. I think they did a masterful job.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's a there's a story that people told a couple, like a year or two ago, but it also applies to what happened in the South with after the Civil War, the rich white guys ended up in control of their land, and most of the poor whites and poor blacks together were sharecroppers. And the only way there was not going to be a division of property after the Civil War was if the white owners could keep the white sharecroppers thinking that their enemy was the black sharecropper.
Nice.
So there's a story. Three guys sit around a table. One guy's a rich guy, one guy's a working man, and another guy's a poor immigrant or whatever, somebody who's somebody you don't like. And a bunch of nickels get poured onto the table. The rich guy scoops them all up. There's one nickel left, and he leans to the white guy and says, "You know, that black guy's looking at your nickel.
He's taking your nickel." Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's exactly
that's
right.
That's how they do it. That's
absolutely
exactly how they do it.
And I've said for years, you know, the way the wealth class beats us is they slice us and dice us and divide us up.
You
you're white,
it.
You're black, you're non-union, you're union, man, woman, whatever, however you want to put it, white collar, blue collar, pink collar, green collar, ring around the collar, it doesn't matter. They've figured out how to slice us and dice us.
I like your focus on unions, Rick, because unity is strength. And if they divide us, like you say, that's how they win. We need to be strong and united.
Absolutely. AmericaBlog.com, the website. Gaius Publius is a contributing editor over there. I suggest that we've got a link at the RickSmithShow.com. Just click on Gaius's name. It'll take you there. I appreciate the time. It was great talking with you.
Oh, my pleasure, Rick.
Look forward to having you back again soon. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Such energy powers as BP, ExxonMobil, Halliburton, and Koch Industries have gone crackers over fracking. Seeing huge profits from this dreadfully destructive and dangerously dirty method of forcing natural gas out of rock formations deep in the earth, the industry is presently scurrying all over the country, asking landowners to sign contracts, allowing them to drill and frack on farms, parkland, playgrounds, and even people's backyards. But now, in cities and rural areas alike, this unbridled gas rush has become a matter of deeply grave concern. Literally, in the shriveled ethical universe of these fracking profiteers, money trumps everything and nothing is sacred. Not even graveyards. The eternal resting place of our loved ones. Yes, gas frackers across the country are out to get drilling rights in hundreds of cemeteries, promising maintenance money to caretakers in exchange for letting the corporations sink their explosive siphons down under the dearly departed. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, and mineral rights to Exxon. How spiritual. Oh, come on, snap the industry's impatient hustlers. The fracking takes place way underground, so it won't disturb the graves. Yeah, but what about the souls? A cemetery is a spiritual sanctuary, a place of respect, serenity, and moral decorum. But a fracking corporation has no soul, and its moral concerns penetrate no deeper than its bottom line. For a measure of just how shallow corporate morality is, Note that the frackers even threaten the hallowed ground of some of our veterans' cemeteries. Their ethos is clear. Hey, out of the way. Decorum is one thing, but there's money under those graves. This is Jim Hightower saying they're fracturing our deepest values. To fight this, go to foodandwaterwatch.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
John, there's a real difference between venture capitalism and vulture capitalism. The fact of the matter is that he's going to have to face up to this at some time or another.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire. The ring of fire.
I gotta tell you, I still think the big cliff, the whole deal, I think it's a bad deal top to bottom. Personally, I would have voted against it. But here we are, set up for the next hostage situation and the next, because you know that's what's gonna play out. Anyway, yesterday we talked a little bit about the lawsuit. Twitter Tom Corbett decided, hey, after I agreed to the suit, if you remember back on July 23rd of this past year, he was all in favor of it. Said, hey, you know, this is part of the corrective process. We need to accept this and then move on. Okay with it. Part of the board of directors said, that's a good, we're gonna go forward. Now when it's politically advantageous, decides, you know what, I'm gonna get the right from the attorney general that is going out of office. And I think for purely political reasons, political opportunism, he decided we're gonna file this suit. Curious your thoughts. I got Jake on line one. Hey, Jake, how we doing tonight?
How you doing, Rick? You kind of stole some of my thunder, but you know, I think if you're really going to understand this situation at all, let me take a couple minutes here. I think it's only fair to kind of go back and look at the history of this thing. I mean, it all started when he was Attorney General, the Governor Corbett. He was Attorney General for two terms. By all accounts, it took him 3 years of investigating the Sandusky situation until indictments came down. And that's just one of the points of contention of some of his political enemies. And Kathleen Kane has made a point of saying, if I become attorney general, which she did, she's going to investigate his conduct. I think it's relevant to mention, and we talked about this when I was still on the show, Rick, the fact that he got a $300,000 contribution from somebody from Second Mile.
Right.
On the BOT, and right after that, when Corbett became governor, he gave them a $3 million state grant. That's all background. So he was involved. He's been involved a long time. Along comes his scandal. Joe Paterno gets fired. By all accounts, he was behind the scenes. He was instrumental in going and lobbying other BOT members to get Joe fired. Joe Paterno gets fired. The indictments come down on the president, the head of the athletic department, and the head of security. They have been indicted, and I believe their trials are scheduled to come up sometime this year.
But I understand all of that. But the question is do you think this is a good thing? Do you think he's doing the right thing? Or do you think, as I do, it's political opportunism?
No.
He doesn't really stand much of a chance, but this is about, and the one quote I saw, making the NCAA look sympathetic.
No, some of these statements, and you repeated one of the quotes. I also saw quotes where after these horrendous penalties were imposed, he made a public statement saying, look, what happened in the Sandusky situation was horrendous, and I don't think any of us would argue with that. But he also said Penn State deserves the penalty that they got. Now, that was a year ago. Now, what was his change? I think if you look at what happened since, and you look not only Tom Corbett, but the reactions of some other Republicans to what the NCAA has done, I think it doesn't take a genius to figure out that, they looked at the polls, they looked at what happened to them during the election. And by the way, if you look at the numbers that Kathleen Kane got in Center County, and you compare that on a percentage basis as to the number of Republicans to Democrats, she probably did better in the center of the state than any other part of the state, and she got correct me if I'm wrong, Rick, she got more votes than anybody.
Yeah.
And it's fair to say that one of the reasons she got a lot of votes up in Center County because her promise to investigate the conduct of, at that time, Attorney General Corbett. And I think they looked around, and since that time, Charlie Dent, the congressman who's going to be my congressman, has attacked the NCAA for not keeping that fine I think this
payment
was $12 million.
$60 million.
And they only wanted to keep a quarter of that in Pennsylvania. Charlie Dent came out. Jake Corman, the state senator, came out. I think the Republicans know that they're really getting shellacked at the polls, and I think this was politically motivated. And what disappointed me was his argument. If you listen to his argument yesterday, Rick, he emphasized the economics. Well, you know, there's more to it than that.
Well, but Jake, I mean, from a legal standpoint, that was the only argument he could conceivably make. Because they agreed to it. You agreed to the deal, so now you're going to take it from an angle that's, from some of the lawyers that I've talked to, fairly difficult, fairly obscure,
yes.
But the
yes.
last leg he's got to stand on.
Mm-hmm. Well, you hit the nail on the head. Penn State University agreed to it, they acquiesced, and he was part of the process.
On the board?
Yes, absolutely. He was part of the process. And now a year later, and what changed? And you look at the landscape. You look at the shellacking that they took, and it doesn't take a genius to figure out that, you know, a lot of it's politically motivated. Oh, and by the way, if you noticed that President Erickson and the BOT stayed out of it, they didn't get involved in that. They distanced themselves, and I think that was deliberate.
Yeah, because I think they read it the same way that most people have read it. And I've seen a lot of different groups. There's a group out there, Penn Staters for Responsible Stewardship, who said, you know, you should have done this back then. You should have done it before you agreed to it.
Absolutely.
And there are a number of other people. I mean, you're a diehard Penn State fan, diehard supporter of Penn State. And I remember us talking about this back when they were going through this. You're saying that they should do something now. And I agreed they should have done something. Now it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
And what this is, to me, purely opportunism. This is purely trying to preempt Kathleen Kane, take some power away from her and take some juice away, just so that they can have some leverage against her if she does unearth something mm-hmm. that he was responsible for.
And if you noticed, he didn't extend her the courtesy of even talking to her about it.
Yeah, I mean,
she's going to be the attorney general.
I mean, doesn't that, for the people who are going to bring us accountability and transparency and all of that stuff, our good government, doesn't it stink to high heaven that on the 2nd of January he announces this where, you know, here, just in less than 2 weeks, you're going to have a change in the Attorney General? And what is it about the Attorney General that we had who would abdicate her responsibility and her job and say, sure, you go ahead, you run with it. I don't want to do my job.
Well, you know the answer there. I'm sure that he says he talked to her, but I'm sure it was more he just told her, I'm taking over. I'm sure that was the situation. And I can tell you, I speak for a lot of people. I would love to tell you that this lawsuit is going to go somewhere because, make no mistake, I think the NCAA did overstep their bounds. Absolutely. I think they absolutely did. And that Free report, who, by the way, Louis Free was recommended by Corbett himself. That Free report, you're going to find, is very incomplete, and he even admitted it. But where was he a year ago when it really mattered?
I mean, my problem is I don't like the NCAA anyway. It's a cartel. It's a monopoly. I'm sorry. It's just I don't think it should have that much power to begin with. But look, they agreed to it. That's my problem.
Yep. It's like closing the barn door after the horses have escaped. Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, the only positive I can see is this going to start some outside pressure on the NCAA? I don't know. I think that's the only way that you're going to reduce some of them. It's going to have to be voluntary on the part of the NCAA. I'm not so sure if you take them to court that you're going to accomplish what you want to. I think the public pressure somehow is going to have to force them to maybe even to lighten the load a little bit. And that may happen. I don't know, but I just look in a crystal ball. That's the only way I can see that Penn State will get some of these horrendous, and they are horrendous, sanctions will be
Yeah, I don't see that happening. I see the NCAA holding firm because, look, they've got the PR on their side. Look, we went after a child molester. I mean, how much higher ground can you possibly have?
Well, there's one thing you're forgetting, Rick. There's a bunch of trials coming up.
Yeah.
And what if those indictments fall on their face? I'm not saying they're going to, but that is a possibility.
You still got the main guy.
Yep. Yep.
All right. Well, you think people are going to smell this as I do, that this is political opportunism?
Oh, absolutely. I'm listening, and I know you don't normally do it, but I keep my thumb on the political pulse of the local communities here in the two county area. And most of the callers are saying, you know, who's he trying to kid?
Yeah, good point.
It's purely political.
All right. Good. I appreciate the call, Jake. Great talking.
All right. Thanks, Rick.
Let's take a quick break. Back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Now who'd have thought that after all, something as simple as rock and roll would save us all? Now who'd have thought that after all, it was rock and roll?
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year? If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
New Gallup USA Today poll out said that a majority of Americans believe that this year, 2013, will be a year of economic difficulty. Is that reality, or is it just what we've been spoon-fed? But with this barrage of the end of the world is coming, oh, the fiscal cliff, we're going to go over. And personally, I think that has a lot to do with it, because you look at car sales were up, a lot of the indicators were up, but we've just been inundated with the message. Sad stuff. Let's go to Washington, D.C. I've got Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Bob, what's going on?
Well, you and I talked about that on, 3 weeks ago, how this was just made, you know, on the brink and pushed, and they should have just let it go and done it right.
Yeah, I mean, cliff after cliff, you know, and then the next one's coming up. I mean,
the debt ceiling, you know, that'll be the end of the world, too.
And then the sequester, and there'll be something else because it seems. And I got to blame your party. It seems like they thrive on that. And one of the things that, you know, some of my conservative friends believe is that government's broken and it's bad. And look, they're proving it.
Well, two things happened, one to conservatives and the others to the liberals. The liberals did something that couldn't be done when I was there with the Republican-controlled Congress, which was to permanentize some Bush tax cuts, unbelievable. And then the conservatives sat there and voted on something that didn't have any reductions in it. So, yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, this whole thing just stinks. And I had the argument made to me today, well, this is what compromise looks like. Nobody's happy. So the argument was made, well, this was probably a good deal. This was the best deal because nobody's happy. I'm going, exactly in what world do you live in?
I don't buy that. I'm with you. I buy it on some things. I don't buy it on this one. This could have been far, far better.
Yeah, and you know, the reality is if you do buy the fact that we have an imminent danger in our debt, you didn't raise enough revenue to pay your bills. Or did I miss something?
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, you talked about the polling in the beginning. Sure, people, you know, hear all this and then they think this is the end of the world. And wait till they're waking up now realizing 77 million people aren't even in this bill with the payroll tax that was supposed to be taken care of in the first place with the bill.
Yeah, and at the end of it, you know, I'm not against the idea of lowering tax rates for the 77 million people that you pointed out, but there was part of me that said, you know, that payroll tax thing, I never liked it because it seemed to me to be a poison pill to destroy Social Security. And there's part of me that says I'm not against the idea of repealing that, but replace it with something else.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, in a well thought out measure, which they could have done and went back retroactively or corrected anything they want. A lot of things could be thought through, but not like this. This one's out there.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, oddly enough, signed with the auto pen. I didn't hear the big outcry. I was expecting to hear a big hue and cry, the conspiratorial, oh, the president didn't really sign it. It was the auto pen.
Truman used an auto pen. Harry Truman used an auto pen. I have used auto pens as a member of Congress. So.
Yeah, but you're not president.
Yeah, well, they'll accuse him of using an auto pen somewhere in a foreign country.
But I did hear him complain. I did hear people complaining that he was on vacation, and how dare he? Because President Bush never took a vacation.
I think the president honestly needs to be out of Washington. This was you know, going. It went through. It just needed his yes. I'm going to do it. I don't even see why he would be around. It was all done. I mean, McConnell and Biden got together, and then Boehner had the vote, and the rest is history.
Are you buying into any of this Chris Christie and Peter King being all outraged at the Republicans for not giving New York the money? Because, you know, I saw it, and it looked to me a nice bit of politicking. You're a little angry. We're gonna call them to task. But at the end of the day, Christie still said, well, I'm not gonna be that angry. If they give me the money, we'll reconsider.
Well, I think Peter King even made some kind of comment. I wish I knew the exact quote, but made some kind of comment of, well, you know, I told the speaker I had to do that. Something to that effect. You know, a lot of drama there. I think Christie would be a little bit more probably genuine on the thing. But, you know, they were threatening to, well, King was going to vote against him for the speaker, but he got, you know, what he wanted. Of course, they handled it horrific, the Republicans did, about the whole Sandy deal. They could have at least explained some of the things they were doing, and they didn't even bother to do that. It caught Cantor off guard, the number two Republican.
But I don't understand why it takes so long. Why, and I agreed with Christie's point. Why 66 days? I mean, as bad as Bush's response to Katrina was, it still was only 10 days before they got some money into that area to try and help folks.
Well, and then they said, well, the state was asking for, you know, too much money, and then they couldn't get the figures together how to offset the stuff. And I don't know. I just think they got wrapped up in everything. Then they brought it forth, and then Boehner said an incredible quote that he didn't want to put people through a second tough vote. They knew it was there.
Yeah, well, heaven forbid you do your job.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Boy, did you hit the nail on the head. You know, it's like last time of people, last election, they didn't want to, the crowds were angry. Well, you know what? You're paid for them to get angry at you. You're paid to take it. You're paid to make tough calls. It's not supposed to be, well, you get your paycheck and we elected you we don't want you to have a tough call, though. Not two in one night.
No, we can't make you make decisions. Gee, I mean, that would make you...
Yeah, some of the statements, besides what happened, some of the statements were absolutely in a lunatic fringe that were coming out of Washington in the last 24 hours.
But for me, I look at this and I go, you know, is it that they're that disconnected, or have we devolved into this, it's all about the ideology of each side and we don't get things done for people? Because at the end of the day, Christie was right. This isn't a Democratic or a Republican issue. It's an American issue. We need to take care of our own in times of crisis.
I was out there, and I think at the time it really honestly functioned a little bit more genuine, not completely. But, you know, there were always conversations. Well, you know, control of the House next time. And both parties do it. If they drop some of that and just actually see what they want to do as a human being and as an entity, maybe as a party, instead of the constant, well, you know, next election, if we do this, maybe they'd function a little bit better.
Yeah, maybe if we didn't run for election starting the day that you took the oath of office, maybe we wouldn't have these problems. I mean, because really, I mean, this is what you're saying. Today, they took the oath of office today. This 113th Congress started today, and already they're running for the 114th.
Well, sure, and that's why I think you saw the Republican votes for this measure in to begin with, the 85 of them. I think it's about the general election in 2 years, not the primary, the general election.
Yeah, and I look at someone like Stephen LaTourette, who I've always had respect for, you know, him leaving, saying, you know what, I had enough, enough.
Oh, LaTourette is one of the best people out there. And he's always been out front. He's always stood up for people. I've seen him get hammered by the last speaker because he dared to support prevailing wage. There are some good guys, both parties and gals out there, but some of the people have just gotten into a political meltdown of some type or political fear. I don't know. Cape fear. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's gone nuts. Did you see Gerald Nadler's comment to the Capitol, New York?
No, what did he say?
He said that something about $1 trillion coin, that the Federal Reserve has the ability to mint $1 trillion coin. It would be a platinum coin. And he could just deposit in the Treasury and pay off your debt.
That's interesting. I haven't heard that one.
And he was asked, you know, are you being serious? And he says, look, it sounds silly, but it's absolutely legal. And he says it would be normally not the proper to consider such a thing, except when you're faced with blackmail to destroy the country's economy. And you have to consider these things. So maybe if we see this crisis of the debt ceiling, we see another hostage situation, maybe Obama just has the Fed issue a platinum $1 trillion coin.
Well, they're going to have a debt ceiling fight. They're going to have an expenditure fight. They're going to have an appropriations fight. And if they really were thinking straight, there are ways to solve this thing. There seriously are, without damaging everybody under the sun. And it's just going to, let's see, you know, how much they want to work together. And then the previous speaker, Hastert, came out and criticized Boehner that, you know, you can't keep having the Democrat votes if you're going to be the speaker. Well, that's bizarre.
Yeah.
In itself.
How about having just votes that on the issues that we need to get things done. I mean, here in Harrisburg, I'm sure you haven't seen the stories, but our infrastructure is crumbling under our feet. We've had, for the last 3 days, a sinkhole each of the last 3 days. Today, 3 days ago, one almost sucked up a garbage truck. Today, one almost sucked up a backhoe. We've got infrastructure that is literally crumbling around us, and we're still fighting over these the latest hostage situation.
Well, yeah, the highway bill, not having a five-year plan, is absolutely incredible. Bush tried to sabotage the highway bill. Andy Card, his former chief of staff, that didn't work. In fact, LaTourette handed him his lunch at that time, Congressman LaTourette and others. But now not having a highway bill, that's a kumbaya bill where, hey, everybody gets some money for the district, which is why you're sent there. Gas taxes sent out are supposed to be sent back. That's a simple one, and they can't even achieve it.
And that's what's concerning to a lot of people, me especially,
sure.
That the things that used to be, like the debt ceiling, for instance, that used to be something to say, we got to pay our bills. We've already spent this money. The money's already obligated. We've got to pay it.
I voted, I think, 6 times my time there on that, and it was a yawn vote, what I call a yawn vote. Yeah, some people made some statements, and you voted, and you went to dinner. It was a yawn vote because, you know, it's the function, and then you do the real process and the expenditure of the appropriation side of the committees. Everybody knows that.
Are there any more of those? Are the yawn votes gone?
No, the yawn votes are gone.
Things that we used to agree on, like the farm bill?
That's gone. The transportation bill's gone. The debt ceiling's gone. They're not yawn. They're drama votes now. It's all drama vote.
Jeez. I guess a lot of it has to do with the 24-hour news cycle. We've got a lot of outlets. I don't know if you saw Al Jazeera bought up Current TV.
Yes, and you know what? All 50,000 people that watch it. what was that about?
Well, Glenn Beck was upset that he didn't get it.
Well, he probably offered what it was worth, and Qatar, who runs Al Jazeera, the gutter, whichever way you want to call it,
but the land was used for earlier. I don't think it was farming. I think it was like grazing land.
Well, there's windmills certainly don't, wind turbines certainly don't interfere with that.
No, not at all. Not at all. I think, you know, my theory about alternative energy is that we should use what we've got. You know, let's say they have wind there. Okay, put up windmills. But, you know, I've been places where there had been hydroelectric dams or mill ponds, you know, old water mills. And it's kind of exciting to, you know, to look at small-scale power production.
Well, sure, and that's what, you know, that's what makes, and I've been talking about the book fairly frequently of late, this little book by Osha Gray Davidson called Clean Break, which talks about the German energy revolution, the Energiewende.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what, and there's this passage early in the book where he talks about, you know, shaking his head in sort of wonderment, wondering if this is some sort of energy Potemkin village that he's looking at as he's riding the train between two cities, and he sees nothing but, you know, windmills everywhere, wind turbines, you know, industrial wind turbines, and solar panels on houses. And for an American to see something like that, having been told, no, you can't, you know, it doesn't work, because that's what the coal industry says around here. By the way, there are now more solar jobs than there are coal jobs, and that's a good sign, and that will continue to grow.
That is a good, yeah, I like that.
But, you know, you do. You look out the train, you look out the car, and you see all these wind turbines, and you go, well, damn, they're making it work.
Yeah. It's not, I don't think it's that hard. I think it's really exciting.
But instead, here in West Virginia, we have Skunk Top Mountains that aren't mountains anymore that you can't put a wind turbine on anymore.
Yeah. Well, I interviewed with a company in Livermore, California, a long time ago. The name of the place was U.S. Wind Power. And they're kind of cool. They made windmills, and they put little computers in the base of each windmill. And when I say little computer, I mean an original IBM PC, you know, with an 8088 processor in it. And, you know, the law had just come in that the electric company had to buy your power, you know, whether they wanted to or not.
Well, and that's, you know, that's a big part of it. It's not just that they have to buy your power. What Osha Gray Davidson talks a lot about is the German feed-in tariff, where small producers of electricity get paid at a higher tariff rate than the massive producers do, because then it makes it economically viable.
Yeah, I like that very much. But even, you know, even with just parity is nice. And what happened was a bunch of doctors invested in this company, intending for it to be a tax loss. And so everybody got bent out of shape when they started making money. And they had a few of the windmills up in Altamont Pass, which is, you know, Altamont and the Grateful Dead, and the, you know, I think some people got killed, you know, a long time ago. But that's the area, and you know, tons of wind, lots of windmills. So I think the company went belly up for some reason, and the guy who ran it was a very, very progressive person. I think he's relocated to Colorado. But, you know, the thing I'm thinking is, I went to college in Connecticut, and you look around Connecticut, there are all these mill ponds that are just sitting there, you know? There were once water mills for one purpose or another, probably running a little factory. And I went to the northwest corner of Montana to a little town called Troy, and there was a pond. They had had hydroelectric power from this pond at some distant time in the past. Hey, it's there, you know.
Yeah.
Patch it up. Maybe you can power, I don't know, 50 homes out of this thing. Maybe not, but I think every little bit helps.
Sure it does. I mean, that's the whole operating theory behind it, isn't it? But if you've got a government that's serious about it, and if you actually ask questions of people who pay bills, you know, remember, the right wing are made up of people that call themselves fiscal conservatives, right, Richard?
Yeah.
So if you say to them, let's take your power bill from $200 a month to 50. Aren't the fiscal conservatives going to absolutely just go wild over that?
Well, we would hope they would.
Except they won't.
Yeah. You know, and someday we'll understand why they think the way they do. But that's a whole other topic. You know, I started asking about your health and what, you know, what your options are, because I'm suffering a little bit in absentia watching you go through this.
No, I don't want you to do that.
Well,
I mean, I appreciate the sympathy, but I don't want you to do that. I mean,
there's
nothing to be done.
Well, my system has faults in it. You know, it's not perfect. And one of them is that we have to operate under conventional rate structures. Before I was even a member of this, it must have been over 20 years ago, I needed a sonogram. And I went to the county, and I said, I need a sonogram. What's it going to cost? And I think they said $300. And then I went to my doctor, who was not part of this, and he said, I'll go across the street from his office, was this little imaging shop, you know? And they charged me a third of that. It's $100.
Right. That's kind of the deal that I got from the cardiologist. They said, well, you know, the hospital will charge you $5,000. If you just bring us $1,500 cash, look at the money you'll save. And I looked at him and said, you know, $1,500, what, do you think I print it every morning?
Yeah, God. Well, I don't know what to do about this, but, you know, we've talked about this business before where, you know, it's good for me to be a commissioner because I have a habit of walking into the swinging door and getting my nose bloody. If anything screwy is going to happen to anybody, it's going to be to me, which is good. I'm a great guinea pig. So
you've also got a good attitude.
I hope. So I go to the hospital for some, you know, the ER, right? And I come out, I don't know, you know, 10 hours later, I come home. And I get no paperwork, nothing, you know, and then 5 months later, I get a bill and a notice from a collection agency, both at the same time. The hospital was run by the Tenet Corporation at that point, and they had their own collection agency. So wham, you know, I get a bill, I forget, you know, $28,000, 10 hours in the emergency room. So I call up the health plan. And I say, what's going on? They said, well, they never sent us a bill. And then, you know, so I call up Tenet, and they say, well, send the bill. You know, I'm covered. Well, you know, why haven't you done it? So then I call, you know, our billing, you know, our billing department a few months later, and I said, by the way, how did that my visit come out, you know, when I was in the hospital? And she said, "Oh yeah, we took care of that. We paid them $78." Okay.
Yeah.
I think it was $78 to retire a $28,000 bill. Something is wrong here.
Look, the for-profit healthcare industry is a giant fraud. Maybe it's our fault for not talking in those terms, Richard. But it is. It's a giant fraud. One of the biggest dodges is that supposedly you say you've got an 80-20 policy with them. You know, pick one.
Yeah, no.
And let's use $100 as the baseline, so it's easy for the mathematically challenged like me.
And me, yeah.
You've got an 80-20 deal, so that means if you've got a $100 procedure, you owe 20. The insurance company owes 80. But they, in turn, negotiate a deal where they only pay 50. So if you pay 20 of 50, then your copay is actually closer to 40%, the 40-some-odd percent, than it is 20%.
Exactly.
And they never disclose that to you, and that's how that phony baloney dodge runs. Hey, Richard, I hate to do it, but I got to get out of here.
Okay, good to talk with you.
Good to talk to you, and thanks for your kind thoughts. I really appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. Well, Jesus, I hope this works out for you.
All right. Later, Richard.
And thank you for Jug of Punch.
Yeah, thanks to Jug of Punch for facilitating the call. You take care.
Okay.
Bye now.
Bye.
Richard calling from California. Time to get out of here. Thanks, everybody. We are close to, but not at, well, not even close. But anyway, we need $120 to finish the fundraising for tonight to keep us on schedule. And it is much appreciated if you can help where you can. And I know that it gets old, the fundraising, but it's the only thing that keeps us going. Thanks to everybody.